Download. Court Theater Artistic Director Charlie Newell. Democrat State Representative Will Gazzardi. And we reload this week's news with DNA Info's Heather Sharon and Chicago Tribune's Ray Long. And now, here's your host, a man who would bathe in corned beef and cabbage if he could, Justin Kaufman.
Just that boiled water at the bottom of that pan. Ah, put that in a bathtub, mix it with some shampoo. Ah, gold. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the download here on 720 WGN. With you till 11 o'clock, I'm Justin Kaufman. Happy St. Patrick's Day. Michigan Avenue running wild tonight. Lots of people in green walking by, hitting up downtown Chicago, celebrating St. Patrick's Day here on March 17, 2017. We've got a big show for you tonight as we wrap up the week that was. What a week it was, too. It's amazing. I was getting ready for reloading this week's news. We're going to do that with Ray Long and Heather Sharon tonight. And I got to say, some of the stuff that I remember, I went back, oh, maybe I'll go back and see what I was talking about on Monday. It's like, we were talking specifically about, do you remember this story? It feels like it was a month and a half ago. Do you remember the healthcare plan and the sort of predictions from the Congressional Budget Office? Remember when that came out, when they said this is going to be 24 million uninsured people in the next decade? And the Trump administration said, fake news. Do you remember that? That was this week. It's crazy. Anyway, we'll talk with Ray and Heather coming up here in the 8 o'clock hour. I'm excited to talk with them. Also very excited to talk with Representative Will Gazzardi. He's going to join us. I think it's very interesting what the Trump budget proposal means for states. I was reading up on it today. It really is it's a conservative budget that pushes the, I guess, the responsibilities to the state level. It says a lot of these things that have been done at the federal level aren't working, and we believe they better can be controlled and I guess, administered at the state level. Well, that's great for 49 other states, right? In the state of Illinois, we still do not have a balanced budget coming up on 2 years' time. What does it mean that the federal government is giving up on some programs and having the state take over when the state does not have a budget in place? Will Gazzardi will join us. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about cuts, arts, EPA, the minimum wage. We got a lot to talk about, so we'll do that after 7:30 tonight with Representative Gazzardi. Also tonight, Charlie Newell joins us, one of the great names in Chicago theater. He's the artistic director at the Court Theater in Hyde Park. This guy has been doing just tremendous work in Hyde Park for decades. He has really taken the Court Theater and made it not just a great Chicago theater, but a regional theater. One on par with all of the regional theaters around the country, really taking a look at the classics, presenting the classics. So we'll talk to him about his new play, which he is directing, play by Tom Stoppard, one of the newer plays by Tom Stoppard, playwright Tom Stoppard. We'll also talk about what it takes to, next year he's got an Arthur Miller play. He's famous for his work with Tony Kushner. He's done so much with classic playwrights. And it's just interesting to see why he does it and what he wants to take out of it and the art that he creates collaborating with these giants in the theater world. So Charlie Newell will join us tonight after we reload the news. So we got a lot to do tonight. I'm excited. You excited, Pete? I think Pete's ready. All right. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Roger Badish. Also production provided by my man, Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman. This is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, you know what? Let's take a break, and then we'll do the carryout, but we'll do another bracket-style carryout where we will crown the story of the day coming up after the break. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. All right, we got a big show tonight, but we start the carryout, special March Madness edition. We've been doing this week, and we continue to do it during the tournament where we do a no-holds-barred March Madness tournament brackets of champions on the story of the day. We go eight seeds on either side, the East and the West. Why don't we start with the one right now? Trump won't shake Merkel's hand. That's the number one story, the number one seed coming out of the East in a weird press conference with German Chancellor Angela Merkel today. President Trump refused to shake her hand. He did it at the beginning, but then during the photo op, Merkel suggested they shake again, and he gave that look. You know that look that your dad gives when he's mad that somebody made fun of his mustache? So was Trump mad at Merkel for some of the things she said in the conference, or was he just being a big misogynist who if he can't get a hug, he won't settle for a handshake, right? Kind of had that vibe. But another strange conference that has America talking. And he'll go up against the number 8 seed, Rob Kardashian from the Kardashians, turns 30. That's really all I got. So let's go ahead and have Trump, Merkel move on to the second round. Hey, you go Kardashian's the 8 seed. What can you do, right? All right, the 4 and the 5. This is a good one. We got to go number 4, St. Patrick's Day. A great speech by the Irish Prime Minister making the rounds today, essentially talking about the Irish and their contributions to this country, talking about immigration, immigrants coming here. It's worth an extra click to hear the volume on Facebook. Also, the celebrations. It's a great time to be in Chicago. St. Patrick's Day, the number 4 seed. The number 5 seed, though, March Madness. Meaningless college basketball that put your meaningful money on. There was gambling snafu today in the big Michigan-Oklahoma State rivalry. Michigan was leading by 4 points with just seconds to go when Oklahoma State chucked up a 3 at the buzzer. Hey, it went in, but Michigan still won. So what's the deal? The rub? Well, Michigan was a 2.5-point favorite. They had it and lost it in the last second. One Vegas sportsbook said the shot created a 6-figure swing in payouts. Wow! That's why we go with St. Patrick's Day, right? Unless you won. Unless for some reason you took Oklahoma City against the spread. In the 3 and 6 to number 3, Trump wiretap. The story continues. Yesterday, Sean Spicer said it was probably the British. Today, they all said, no, that's what Fox News told us. Of course, the British are livid. There are rumors of an official apology, then rumors of no such apology. Because that's right, we're here in America, and we say what we want when we want it. To quote the most American of all, Beyonce, sorry, I ain't sorry. The number 6 seed, New Zealand airport security, had a beloved drug dog who, for whatever reason, got off the leash and ran onto a runway at the airport. So they did what any self-respecting private security force would do. They shot the dog. They killed the dog. I mean, to their defense, there were signs. You can't go on the runway. I get it. But now the world outraged. I got to say, our first upset, moving to the second round, the dog airport story moves on. And they will take on the winner of the 2-7 matchup. The 2 Secret Service laptop stolen out of a parked car in Brooklyn. First reports were the secrets of the Loch Ness were on this computer. But now, the national secrets aren't on the computer, but the computer could access certain servers. In terms of who stole the computer, police say they have a video. So this is either a plot line from 24 or a random thief who will now use the computer to store his naked pictures of celebrities. Right? Either way, I hope there are emails from Hillary Clinton on it. That's all I can hope for. That's all we can all hope for. Number 7, the DePaul women's basketball team wins their first round game. They beat Northern Iowa, and they'll move on to play Mississippi State this weekend, who put up 110 points today. Go Coach Bruno! I think it had something to do with us and our motivating conversation we had earlier in the week. But you know what? Espionage or, you know, random petty theft wins out. Secret Service laptop moves on. Let's go to the West. The number 1 story in the West has to be Trump budget cuts, or as I call it, in-your-face blue states. Although it's always the red state arts or public broadcasting companies that will be adversely affected by something like this. It may be a bump in the road for a Chicago theater company, but if you're trying to get kids involved in the arts in downstate Illinois without government funding, good luck. They're going up against number 8, Wilson Phillips, coming to Talia Hall. So that's going to have to be American arts from here on out, is the Wilson Phillips reunion tour. We'll go with the budget to move on. In the 4 seed, the Bulls back on the floor tonight against the Wizards. It's the first game in the D-Wade, post-D-Wade era after he breaks an elbow. Watch, they're going to roll off like 10 in a row. You know, oh, they're really coming together. It was D-Wade. He was the problem with his weird undershirt and his spandex on one arm only. That was throwing the team chemistry off. Number 5, Arkansas. The state vote to separate MLK Day and General Lee Day. It's a story I didn't know about, but I guess in some southern states, those holidays are on the same day in January. I mean, I guess both sides are equally upset, so this is literally a win-win. Right? All right, well, we'll stay local and stay away from that debate and say D-Wadeless Bulls moves on to the next round. The 3-6 preemptive strikes on North Korea. Tillerson says diplomacy has failed and that North Korea could start a nuclear war. So a preemptive strike on the country is not out of the question. Wow. Those are some big words. Number 6, April the giraffe is pregnant. And the New York State Animal Adventure Park has set up a webcam to watch. So that is pretty great. And I have to say, you know what? I don't remember even what the number 3 was. I think we go with giraffe. April the giraffe moves on. Then down into 2-7, we've got Northwestern preparing for the big game against the Zags tomorrow night. So exciting. Chicago getting ready for the big game. You can hear it right here on 720 WGN tomorrow afternoon. They'll go up against number 7. The 7 Illinois JCPenney's that will close as part of the 138 store downsizing. So if you're looking for a Tommy Bahama golf shirt or a Cuisinart, you're going to have to go to Kohl's. Let's go with Northwestern, right? The Zags, Northwestern moves on. All right, we ready? We got the Elite Eight. So Pete Zimmerman, you could jump in here if you want. The number 1 seed, Merkle, the handshake, goes up against St. Patrick's Day. It's a tough one. You know, St. Patrick's Day, of course, a big deal. And a big deal in Chicago with the Irish immigrants and the Irish here in Chicago. But that Merkle handshake, that was good business today.
Yeah, you got to go Merkle.
Merkle.
To move on.
The Merkle handshake moves on. Heard all across the world. The Merkle handshake moves on to the Final Four. And then we've got the dog who was shot at the New Zealand airport. Ugh. First, the stolen laptop out of a Secret Service car in Brooklyn. Strange. It seems like a... I don't know. I know in Chicago, like, maybe I won't leave my laptop in my parked car on the side street, but I guess Secret Service has different rules. This is a tough one. I would probably think that the laptop is a bigger deal, but it seems like the dog story is a little bit of an outrage.
Yeah, I'm still going to go with the laptop, I think, to move on.
Laptop to move on. So Merkle and laptop have moved to the Final Four. Go to the other side where we've got the budget cuts, the Trump budget cut story, versus D-Wade-less Bulls. I say budget cuts just because it's more interesting than the D-Wade-less Bulls.
Because he still may come back for the playoffs.
And they may still fund the NEA. So it goes one way or the other, right? All right, so we'll do budget cuts. And then on the final spot for the Final Four, we have April the Giraffe versus Northwestern getting ready to play the Zags. And the only reason that I don't pick Northwestern here is because it's just a prep day. This is about the biggest news story of the day.
Of today.
Yesterday, they won the big game. That would have won the tournament yesterday. Mm-hmm. Today, it's a 2 seed. It's just a prep day. This is the one like, well, they're enjoying themselves. They're having some downtime. Then they're going to watch some film. They're going to eat some pizza, and they're going to go to bed. Right? That's essentially the story we'll hear tonight in the 10 o'clock news. But Northwestern faithful are excited. Then there'll be a shot of Julia Louis-Dreyfus. Then they'll be back to the kids going, this is great. I love it. And then that'll be it. I don't know if that's enough to be the big story. And come on, the giraffe's going to have a baby on a webcam.
Yeah. Krista up in engineering, she's fascinated with that webcam, so I get an update every single day when I
The doctor today said significant baby kicks. That's all I saw in the story. Significant baby kicks. So that's good. April's got that going for him, which is nice. All right, the Final Four, then we got the Merkle handshake versus the stolen laptop, and on the other side, Trump budget cuts versus April the giraffe. It's perfect. All right, the Final Four. Here we go. Merkel's handshake. And the big story on this is it seemed like maybe Angela Merkel had kind of taken a shot at him in the press conference right before this, where she said, let's stop talking about each other and let's talk to each other. And is it possible that Donald Trump did this out of spite? The other theory that I hear is that he doesn't like to shake hands during that time because he hates it so much. He hates all the cameras going off and all this kind of stuff.
And he is a bit of a germaphobe.
Right.
He's made that known.
But we've seen in some other cases where he's talked to other world leaders, he has done that weird handshake where he tries to grab him into him. You know what I'm talking about? Like, he just grabs, like he's, come give him, go,
really
take
does.
That, or I'm going to take your hand, I'm going to
like
take your arm off.
Out of the socket.
So there's that versus the laptop story, which is kind of a dumb story. It's just kind of funny that I love when something happens to the Secret Service that could happen to you. You know, that concept that, oh, yeah, well, how many people in Wicker Park or in Logan Square or in Rogers Park or wherever in Chicago have had a situation where they've left something in their car and a window got bashed out?
Mm-hmm.
Now, how kind of delicious is it that what if the thing they took actually has all of our country's secrets in it, and it makes you wonder if that should probably not be the case, right? Maybe, just maybe, the Secret Service shouldn't have that information. That's just my thought on it.
Yeah.
But I think it has to be Merkel. That's the big, the number one seed, because the laptop, I think at the end of the day, it's just all like blown out of proportion anxiety. I don't think the kid who has it, who's trying to melt it down for $25, cares that he might be able to attach it to the dark web and might be able to get to a server that might tell us exactly where Jimmy Hoffa is buried. I don't, you know what I mean? Like, I'm not sure it goes that far, right?
Yeah, let's go to the handshake.
Let's go to the handshake. The handshake makes it to the final. Okay, and on the other side, budget cuts versus April the Giraffe. Maybe I go to Rob Martire on this one. Does he like the Trump budget cuts, or does he like April the Giraffe, the webcam? I don't know. That's a tough one. What do you say, Pete?
I'd hate to go two Trump stories against each other.
And so, since we're going to talk about the Trump story all night tonight, the budget cuts.
Yeah.
I mean, the giraffe is pregnant.
But she didn't have the baby yet, though. I think that's the huge story. This is a toss-up.
Yeah, what do you think? Let's go to Rob. He'll be the judge on this one.
Going to project forward, guys. I can see Jim Nance, the final. We're down from 64 to two teams. All of a sudden, Nance, just as some guy's going up for a game-winning three, he's going to go, wait!
Wait,
the giraffe has had the baby. The giraffe has had. Let's go to the news desk in New York. The giraffe has had the baby.
They'll pull Dan Rather out.
Right.
He'll be back on the desk like, I'm out of retirement for this big story. All right, so there you go. April Giraffe versus the handshake Merkel. I think it's a, if that, you're right, Pete. This is the tough part, is like the baby hasn't come yet.
Mm-hmm.
The handshake didn't happen. I mean, there's a really sort of two stories about anticipation and what it means. So I'm not sure where to go. Do you go April the Giraffe and the webcam and the waiting for the giraffe in New York State to have a baby? Or do you go the Angela Merkel meeting, which really has no impact on the world, if you think about it, because they just didn't shake hands?
But for today's news story, Merkel, Trump.
Merkel, Trump. Rob, you agree?
That'd be my vote.
No, I mean, Pete makes a very valid point. Absolutely.
There you go.
Merkel-Trump.
Merkel-Trump. There we go. The handshake that did not happen is the story of the day. We did it. We got to the story of the day. They are crowned champions, or at least the most important story of the day. That was intense. That was an anxious one. Coming up, Will Gazzardi is going to join us. We'll talk about budget cuts. We'll talk about the state budget and what it means for the state when we talk about the EPA, arts, minimum wage, and other stories. It's a download here on 720 WGN. Stay with us.
Justin, Pete, if you'll indulge me for about 15 seconds here, I just want to say get well to my beautiful baby girl, five-year-old little Ava Martire. She broke her elbow Tuesday night. She was trying to do her best impersonation of Simone Biles' Triple Lindy in the living room. Her body kept going, her arm stayed put, and, well, the rest is history.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, so get well, sweetie.
Yeah, get well.
Yeah.
That's a tough story, but you know what? It's the setup story for in the Olympic package.
Sure.
You know, and it's like, and then when she was five,
right,
her elbow didn't, you know, her elbow broke, but she persevered. She went through that adversity.
She compensated so much that her left arm became the size of Arnold Schwarzenegger's thigh. She is now a power lifter of world renown. Exactly.
Yes, that's how that ends. That's exactly where we're going with that. So
get well, Ava.
Well, get well. There you go. Thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, the big Trump administration federal budget proposal came out earlier this week, and it was quite a doozy. Really tremendous budget proposal when it comes to American history and the idea that really starting to get at some of the social programs, arts programs, other places, and instead of just sort of, you know, maybe starting the plan to defund or taking away or giving cuts. I mean, we say cuts. These are massive, massive changes to the way government works. Some areas, the National Endowment for the Arts being one, just scrapped entirely. the idea of just gutting the budget. What does that mean for the state of Illinois? But also, what does it mean for politics in the state of Illinois? Because what this budget really is about, it's about pushing the emphasis of being able to take care of social programs, arts programs, other things to the state level. And that may work in 49 other states, but maybe not so much in the state of Illinois when it comes to what's happening in Springfield with our issues over balancing our own budget. On the line with me now, Will Gazzardi. He's a Democrat state representative from 39th District. He joins us regularly here on The Download. Representative Gazzardi, good to talk to you.
Justin, it's great to be back on the show.
So let me ask you about that. I mean, that's a I'm interested in what your thought is on the idea that really this federal budget is saying, you know what, we need to push this down to the state level. Do you feel more pressure as a lawmaker in Springfield to get a balanced budget done in the face of what's happening at the federal level?
I'm not sure there's much more pressure we could feel than we're already feeling from the, you know, the crisis in the state budget has had enormous human impact on the people who we represent. But this budget that Donald Trump is proposing is going to double down on that impact. I mean, you know, I think a lot of people who supported Trump as a candidate were expecting really something new and revolutionary from him. But he's going back to sort of old school Republican mantra of spend a whole heck of a lot of our money on planes and military equipment and cut funding for services to people who need it. And, you know, it's just old school 90s era Republican stuff. And I got to imagine that a lot of his supporters are going to be disappointed, not to mention those of us who care about the programs that he's proposing to gut.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because it seems to be, I was reading a bunch of thought pieces about the budget, and you're right. I mean, it doesn't necessarily it doesn't earn the sort of praise of the libertarians among us or the conservatives even. This is a straight sort of red state Republican budget. And it also is viewed as sort of like a poke in the eye to the blue states. This is really just sort of like political payback. Do you see it that way? Do you see it as a Democratic representative in a blue state? Do you see it as sort of to the winners go the spoils?
You know, maybe the president is trying to send a political message here. But I mean, what this budget is, it's not a poke in the eye to blue states. It's a poke in the eye to the elderly. It's a poke in the eye to our children in public education. It's a poke in the eye to people who rely on Meals on Wheels. You know, it's a poke in the eye to people who need government to help them get by, to the sick, to the disabled, to the elderly, to our children. So, you know, if the president is trying to score political points, so be it. But he's going to hurt a whole lot of people in the process.
Well, what do you say as someone who, you know, has been in Springfield for a couple of years now, the concept of, you know, this really being what a Republican representative or administration or president or anyone with the political leanings that are a little bit more conservative, they're praising this. They believe in the idea right. that, you know what, we shouldn't be paying for Big Bird. We shouldn't be paying for arts. We need to get to a point right. where if you got to be able to survive on your own and we're not going to be doing these handouts anymore. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is it's incredibly callous. And, you know, frankly, this is not that different from what Governor Rauner came in and proposed in here in Illinois. You know, if Governor Rauner could have spent money on planes and tanks, maybe he would have. But everything else is just the same. You know, cut services to people who need them, make it harder for working families to get by. And, you know, while we're at it, throw in hundreds of billions of dollars in tax breaks to the very wealthy, as Trump is doing. Or in Rauner's case, it's only billions because the Illinois budget's a little smaller. But, you know, massive tax breaks to the very rich, huge corporate loopholes, and the rest of us can go take a hike.
There's something to be said about it. And I did recognize this as well, you know, sort of pivoting to another part of the budget, that this is just the discretionary spending part of the federal budget. There's other places, Social Security and healthcare and other things that are growing, and it's going to, we're not paying down the debt. We're not actually making government shrink. This is just an ideology switch. And when you hear that or see the budget and you also live it with what's happening in the state of Illinois, how do you, as a Democratic representative, how do you find a common ground when ideology plays out more than sort of numbers on a spreadsheet?
Well, Liz, I mean, I think at the end of the day, most of my Republican colleagues in Springfield, you know, the governor's maybe a different animal, but most of my colleagues share a lot of my same values. You know, they believe in the importance of education for children starting at birth and all the way through college. You know, they believe in the importance of caring for the elderly, caring for people when they fall ill. They believe in the importance of making sure that, you know, a hard day's work is rewarded with decent wages. So I think there's a lot more common ground among the parties than people think. But, you know, hardcore ideologues like Governor Rauner or I don't even know how to describe President Trump, because sometimes he seems like a hardcore ideologue and sometimes he seems like he's just pulling things out of thin air. Anyway, you know, we have to call out the fact that they're not speaking to the mainstream values that Republicans and Democrats alike all share. These guys are on the fringe talking about changes that will harm the core values, public education, public welfare, decent health care for people who need it, those core values that we all really share.
Let me ask you the same thing I asked Karen Lewis, though. This is, I mean, there, we all can agree that in some cases, a lot of these programs that were brought in by the federal government and the state government were to take on poverty and some of the stuff that happened in the 60s to have federal programs to take on. There's an argument, I think, that it's shared by Republicans and Democrats that you have seen many times over that it hasn't worked. And I was talking to Karen about the idea that, you know, possibly public education may be broke. Now, I'm not saying that the way that the proposals that Governor Rauner or President Trump or Speaker Madigan are putting forth to change it are the best way forward. But we all can agree that maybe staying with what is happening in our country might not be the right course of action.
Yeah, listen, I understand that. And things feel pretty profoundly broken right now. But, you know, public education really did work in this country. I mean, and around the world, you know, the idea that everybody should be able to have access to basic education has lifted billions of people on this planet out of poverty. It's created, you know, widespread literacy rates, and it's really changed the face of human society. And now the reason public education isn't working now here in America, it's not because all of a sudden that idea failed. It's because we've been systematically disinvesting from public education. And now we say, oh, look, it's not working. Well, yeah, once you cut it and cut it and cut it until there's nothing left, all of a sudden you say it's not working. Like, whose fault is that? It's not the fault of public education as an idea. I think we have to invest in those things that help everyone in our society. You have to, you know, I mean, I could go on a whole rant about college affordability. We'll maybe do that later in the program. But, you know, people believe in the public good, and we got to stand up for it. Yeah.
Representative Will Guzzardi is on the line with me. He's a Democrat from the 39th District, represents parts of the north, I say west side, west, northwest side areas, Logan Square and so in Chicago. Let's talk about the EPA. This is one, I mean, we start getting into the specifics, but the EPA, there have been, you know, workers from the EPA here in Chicago who have protested in the last couple of weeks, but the cuts that came up in the budget proposal were really the same kind of concept that one in five people who work for the EPA will be let go, especially when it comes to the state of Illinois, the Great Lakes. What's at stake when it comes to EPA cuts? What does the state of Illinois lose when an administration wants to shrink the size of that agency?
Yeah, I mean, that's a perfect example of how this budget and the sort of Trump-Rauner agenda is out of step with values that people across the political spectrum share. We all believe that polluting corporations shouldn't have the right to poison our air and water. That is a widely held belief. And I tell you, a lot of the people who live in what people think of as, you know, Trump's America are the same folks who can light their tap water on fire because of the poison that's been introduced into the water table, right? Americans rely profoundly on government regulation of out-of-control corporations for our basic health and welfare. And, you know, slashing the EPA isn't some gotcha to the Democrats. It's a way to poison the American people and allow big corporations to make a you know, extra profit in doing so.
But Will, they'll come back. The Republican governors and presidents and lawmakers will come back and say they believe in those values. They just think that the way that we're approaching it with the Environmental Protection Agency and the way it's set up is inefficient.
Well, I tell you, I mean, I can't. It's hard for me to believe the argument that the regulations that are currently in place are too onerous on companies like, you know, BP and ExxonMobil, who are making multi-gazillion dollar profits every year. I don't think our regulations are really slowing them down too bad.
Yeah. All right, my last question, and this is an interesting one because this is something that you put out. This is you're sponsoring the bill to make the minimum wage $15 an hour here in the state of Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested in this because, you know, this goes, I feel like reading about it, which, you know, this is a big push for you, and it's something that that you really want to put back on the table. It goes almost hand in hand, step in step, with the Trump administration saying, you know, we want to give this back to the people, we want to give it to the state. I mean, there's a way to almost connect those two things, because your concept is we can get rid of entitlements and get rid of sort of handouts, quote unquote, if we give the people more money.
Yeah, I mean, listen, people talk about $15 an hour like it's some sort of generous blessing of a salary that someone might earn. $15 an hour, if you do the math, if you work 40 hours a week, which most people who work low-wage jobs don't get that many hours, but if you work 40 hours a week, that's $30,000 a year. And that's not enough to get by in Chicago, and it's not enough to get by in a lot of other communities in Illinois, in Rockford and Carbondale and Danville. That's as a single person, let alone imagine that you're raising a family. You know, I think there's other misconception that, oh, minimum wage jobs are for high school kids, you know, right, in the summer break. A whole lot of these folks are, you know, raising families on their own. So, yes, what we want to do, we want people to be able to work a decent job for a decent amount of time and have enough money in their pocket to take care of their family and not have to rely on government programs. That's the idea here.
This issue is very similar to what we were just talking about finding that mainstream value. Where it doesn't matter about politics, we all believe in that we should get paid a living wage or a fair wage. Who's in opposition of raising the minimum wage in the state of Illinois? Is it the governor? Is it business interests? Who doesn't want it to go from, what is it, $9 now to $15?
It's $8.25 right now, and we're talking about raising it slowly until 2022, so it'll be about $1 a year. And the way we're designing it is also going to have a tax credit for small employers, for people with fewer than 50 employees, to help them ease the burden. So, you know, you'll hear that the business community is opposed to this, but it's not the business community at large. Most of the small business owners I know here in my district, they really want to pay their employees $15 an hour. And, you know, they think if they get a little help with their tax bill, they could probably manage it. But, you know, the people who are opposed to it are the enormous multinational corporations who, you know, thrive on paying their employees $8.25 an hour and then telling their employees, hey, look, that's not enough money to live on. So, you know, go get on food stamps, go get on Medicaid in order to get by. So they're, you know, passing the buck to the taxpayer so that they can enrich their own bottom line. And they want to keep taking advantage of the taxpayers of this state to pad their profits. Yeah. And that's why they're opposed.
Well, we'll pay attention to this, and we'd love to have you back on to talk about how this moves through the House and in Springfield. Representative Will Guzzardi represents the 39th District here in the Chicago area, Democrat. Thanks for joining us. We'll appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on the show. Great talking with you.
All right, coming up after Rob's news, we're going to break down this week's news. We'll reload the news with Ray Long and Heather Sharone in studio. We got a lot to talk about, man. This is going to be a crazy week. Just the concept alone of that we only talk about one week. I'm like, well, there's a lot going on this week. And then I started to look back to like Monday or Tuesday, and I'm like, that seems like that was done. That was like January news. It's been that long. But we'll do it like we do every week here, 312-981-7200. What's the biggest story? Overreported, underreported, winners and losers? What story sucked you down the rabbit hole? And which story will be remembered in 5, 10, 50, 500 years from this week? We'll do all that coming up after Rob's news. Thanks, Rob. Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. It's time to reload this week's news. What a week it was. Lots to talk about, from Northwestern Wildcats success history. Maybe that's the story. Maybe that's the story that we'll remember in 5, 10, 50, 500 years from now. Or maybe it'll be the Trump budget. Or maybe something, maybe the giraffe. Maybe April the giraffe finally having that baby. Hopefully it happens this week. In studio with me tonight to break down this week's news, Heather Sharone. She is a City Hall reporter for DNA Info. Good to see you, Heather.
Thanks for having me, Justin.
And, of course, Ray Long, investigative reporter at the Chicago Tribune, as well as the former Springfield bureau chief. Good to see you, buddy.
Good to see you too.
All right, so let's get right to it. This is a little bit of a toss up because Northwestern obviously is a big sports story, but the biggest story of the week, Ray, what do you got as the biggest story of this week?
Well, I would just like to add to that Northwestern thing that, you know, later in the show you talk about what is remembered 500 years from now. I don't want to steal the thunder early, but really, they're undefeated for 79 years in the NCAA tournament.
No other university can claim that.
No, that's right. They're undefeated. Someone's going to make a compassionate sports movie about that.
Yes,
undefeated. All right, so what do you got for biggest story?
I got to say it's the Trump budget. It changes. It really shifts the whole dynamic of this nation if it goes through in any kind of form similar to the way he proposed it. Just here in Chicago, $300 million for the Great Lakes restoration could be zeroed out. That's what he's calling for. And so there's also, and Heather knows more about this, but $19 million that the city could be losing too. And so there's all kinds of repercussions, sanctuary cities, et cetera, et cetera. This is really a clarion call for a lot of people who want to stand up for the environment, stand up for the arts, stand up for sanctuary cities, immigration, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah.
The mayor was very clear this morning that he views budgets as almost moral documents. And I think it's true. You spend your money on things you care about. If you care about the ballet, you've got a membership. If you care about art, you go to the Art Institute. And he said that Trump's budget just doesn't represent the values that he believes Chicago holds. And, he said that he didn't think it was going to go through.
But that's the question, right?
But that he was disappointed that Democrats in Congress, and of course he's a former congressman, you know, almost Speaker of the House, former Chief of Staff to Barack Obama, that he was disappointed there would have to be fights to get us back to where we are at this point to just sort of maintain.
Well, do you think that is this really a budget that specializes in number crunching, or is this really sort of like a shot across the bow or just ideology?
You know, I think that when you have somebody like Senator John McCain come out right away as soon as it's released saying that budget will not pass the Senate, I think that gives you a sense of perhaps the crystal ball, prognostication of what it could happen. But I think Ray is right. It shifts the conversation to, should we fund the arts? That's a question we were not asking four years
Ray,
ago.
Ray, I would ask that. I mean, it's interesting because the actual numbers, the budget doesn't, it's not an exercise in shrinking the budget.
Right.
It's not getting us back. That has nothing to do with debt. This really is just shifting money, saying we're going to give a ton of money to military. Yeah. Everything else can go away.
A billion more for nuclear weapons is that kind of thing. One of the things that strikes me also is that it's sort of counter-populist in many ways, because even though Trump ran a populist campaign, we all know that, we all saw that, but we're seeing now that he's looking at cutting areas that could really hurt the people who voted for him. And I think that's very strange, but there's also parts of this budget that I think are more traditional conservative Republican values here. And so he's introducing a budget that is more with the established conservatives, probably because they're more organized, right? And so he has to work with them to some degree, and plus it's a mammoth thing to try to just shift all these different areas that he's
talking
about.
When you create an ideology, or at least a discussion in America, where it plays the idea that, we shouldn't have handouts. No one should get something free. Right. I mean, that's a lot of the voters will come out and say, yeah, I agree with this because I don't want my tax money going to something I don't believe in. I mean, that is a false kind of discussion, because the biggest spending areas that the government spend has nothing to do with this stuff. It has to do with health care. It has to do with Social Security. It has nothing to do with whether or not you're funding the National Endowment for the Arts.
Well, it also depends on how you define handout. Is the mortgage interest tax deduction, which primarily middle class people benefit from, is that a handout? What about farm subsidies? What about, a whole host of things that, if you listen to primarily Republicans, they would not consider to be government handouts.
Right.
However, you know, I think if you total them up, they would probably, even today, spend more on programs like that than they would on food stamps or, you know, the arts or PBS or, you know, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Well, they made a strong, I mean, the budget director made a strong point, and you can argue with it all day long, but the idea that, you know, I can't continue to look at coal miners in the eye and the face and say, hey, we're going to give your money to Big Bird. I mean, that concept is a concept that has not just played out this year. It's been something we've been arguing about since Ronald Reagan.
Well, absolutely. And you see this year the kind of long-term effects of people being unemployed and being underemployed. And you see that they're not getting those jobs back. And that is what really played to the Trump crowd. You know, the union guys in Ohio are going to be saying, hey, I need to have that job back in the mine, right? I need to have that job back in the factory, those kinds of things. They weren't worried about Hillary Clinton's issues on gender and all of the other types of things that may be politically correct.
Well, it's very interesting. This is going to be an interesting one.
Well, I think there was a story in the Washington Post this week that interviewed people who went to the president's rally in Nashville, and they spoke to a family who one person had just lost their job. And because they lost their job, they qualified for a higher health care subsidy. And the reporter in me, you know, caught my breath and sort of had a really, you know, sort of honestly sick feeling in my stomach, because that woman had thought that the president had already passed his health care program, and that was why they got more benefits, when, of course, those benefits were provided for by Obama. And, you know, it's Friday. On Monday, you know, if we'd been doing this on Monday, the big story would have been the Congressional Budget Office telling us that untold millions of people were going to lose health care.
And subsidies it's interesting. You go right back to the same conversation about handouts and entitlements. Subsidies have, for all of the arguments that we've heard about, you know, the death spirals and what's happening to Obamacare, the subsidies were on a scale. If the premium went up, the subsidy went up. That has changed in the new American Health Care Act that is being proposed in Congress. Lots to talk about. We'll continue to talk about. Ray Long, Heather Sharon in studio. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll do overreported and underreported here on The Download, 720 WGN. Breaking down, reloading this week's news on The Download. Ray Long, Heather Sharon in studio. Heather is City Hall reporter for DNA Info, dnainfo.com. Also, Ray Long is an investigative reporter for the Chicago Tribune, former bureau chief in Springfield. All right, before we move, let's keep going. Let's go to Anthony. Anthony, what do you want to say about the Trump budget proposal?
Well, I just particularly, I was listening to Sharon's comments about the mortgage insurance break
The
middle-class homeowners get. You know, at the end of the day, the middle class is still paying taxes at the end of the year. I'd like to see entitlement stop the people who've been on government dole from cradle to grave. You know, there's a difference in getting a little something back and living off other people.
Sure.
You know, let's cut those out.
Well,
you know,
I mean, there's no doubt about that. But I would also push back in saying a lot of cuts to the EPA, cuts to the arts, the NEA, other places aren't necessarily affecting that argument.
Well, I'd rather see those things not cut and cut back on the welfare and the food stamp program. And as far as the Obamacare, that was about to fail. Democrats keep acting like, you know, that Trump's coming in and ruining something that's doing well. More insurers are pulling out of that. It's got about 3 years left at the current pace that it's going. Something has to be done regardless.
Right. Well, no doubt about that, Anthony.
So to try to blame Trump trying to take insurance for millions of people, you know, I don't know. We got to do something different. In Illinois, to complain about losing federal funds when they continue to defy federal law, hey, you know, what goes around comes around. You know, maybe if you got on board, maybe some more money would come your way.
Thanks, Anthony. I mean, thanks for that.
Okay.
Thanks, buddy.
All right.
Sorry about that. I had to cut him off there. There's a lot there. I mean, I think that what you're getting there from Anthony is that bootstrap conversation, that if you take away entitlements, food stamps, other places to the poor, to people in poverty, you may, you know, like they'll figure it out. You know,
yeah,
like, and I feel like there's that argument's been going on for as long as I've been born.
Right. There are some people who could use more help than others. There's just no doubt about that.
Right.
And, you know, you can argue that, well, they should work harder and all that, or they should try to find a job, or they should do this or that. But, you know, when you get past it, not everybody is capable of doing the kind of things that everybody else can, that the general populace can.
And not everybody starts from the same spot.
Right.
Right.
You know what
exactly.
I mean? If you, you know,
absolutely.
If you grow up in a house where, you know, your parents didn't go to college, maybe didn't even graduate high school, you know, the stats, the data show that you start at a disadvantage. Yeah. And the question is, and I don't know the answer to this question, you know, do we as a society want to pool our money and say we are going to help those who start at a disadvantage, whether that be race, whether that be class? And that, I think, was what the mayor was getting at this morning when he said that, you know, we in Chicago embrace these values, at least, you know, in his mind, and that is not reflected in the Trump budget.
312-981-7200. We are reloading this week's news. Let's move on to overreported and underreported. I think we all agree. We all came back with the same assessment from this week that the most overreported story was the Trump tax returns. When we come back.
Yeah. Yes.
It was Rachel Maddow got to the 2005 tax returns of Donald Trump, made a show out of it. Got social media all worked up and really didn't give us much more than we already knew.
Yeah. I mean, she did have the cover sheets, basically, of a 2005 Donald Trump tax return. But when you first saw it on Twitter, you thought, holy smoke, somebody has really unloaded it all. You're going to hear everything.
And
you're going to learn a lot.
The danger of hype. I mean, I don't know. I've been accused of being old school, but, you know, I have a hard time sometimes, you know, tweeting my stories and saying, hey, look at what I'm doing, because I think that hype can be such a double-edged sword.
Rachel's great in being able to tell a story, and she's done great with sort of expanding a story. It was a tweet in question where it says, we have Donald Trump's tax returns. Seriously.
Yeah.
And it just got everybody, and I think that they would probably go back and redo that tweet, because I think that that made the expectations, like you said, Ray, that we were going to get everything. We're finally going to get this story that everybody's been asking for, going to rallies over everything. And when we found out what it was, just a cover sheet from 2005, that in the weirdest where we're living, the idea of where we're living, that it could have possibly been leaked by the president. That's the story itself is another one of these, like, just brain squeezes.
Well, if there was news there, it was that President Trump paid the alternative minimum tax, and he wants to do away with the alternative minimum tax.
That was a good point.
So that if his proposal had been law, he would have not paid $25 million in taxes. He would have paid closer to $5 million in taxes. And I think that that is, you know, a reasonable thing to sort of question, you know, how would, you know, a president's policies affect their family? I think it's a reasonable question. But again, I get back to the hype. If that tweet said, in 2005, President Trump paid X, you know, but his proposals would have had him pay Y, I think it's a completely different media
may have
event.
Resonated even more. I mean, because it became a media story instead of a story about what was actually in the tax return.
I think they probably drew eyeballs to Rachel's show, and I was tuned in. I usually don't tune into Rachel. I do
you
occasionally.
Fell for it,
right?
But you
yeah,
fell for
sure.
It.
Yeah, I was suckered in. Well, I had to check it out is what happened. So,
a likely story.
Yes.
Yeah,
but,
I mean.
But yeah, it was just bringing people in, and then she just played it out for way too long. She could have said, hey, this is what it is, blah, blah, blah. She gave a long kind of anti-Trump.
It's the worst case of burying the lead I've ever seen.
Yeah.
It really was.
Yeah, that's a good point.
You know,
yeah.
I guess, you know, it also brought up the question that there was a 2005 tax return. We're not sure where it came from. It was a leaked document. It was client copy, so it came from someone who had access to the actual client tax returns, Donald Trump's. But it again brought up this idea that the White House jumped in front of that story. And they released the information beforehand. And it just begs the question, why are we playing this game? Why are we not having access to 2006 to 2016? What is happening when it – because I don't even know what the argument is anymore, because I thought he was under – I thought it was an audit. There was always this sort of flimsy excuse about it. So why is the president not giving his tax returns? And does that actually hurt – or create, give rise to the chaos theory that surrounds what's in it?
Well,
I mean, the argument during the election was it had to be pretty bad if he wasn't just releasing it and just, you know, the, you know, Ray and I have heard it. You know, it's not the cover up that it's not the crime that's going to kill you. It's the cover up that's going to kill you.
Right.
You know, I don't know what those are in those tax returns. Would I want somebody to mail them to me, as apparently happened to David K. Johnson? Sure. Yeah. Go ahead. You know, my address is.
Yeah, no. Right.
But, you know, it's all about context. I also think that what we saw on social media was sort of this, you know, desire for some smoking gun. You know what I mean? Because I saw so many tweets, this is it. This is it. You know what I mean? And, you know, I love history. And, you know, Watergate was a steady drip, 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 drip of, you know, of, okay, this piece fits and that piece fits. And I don't know if it's because the news cycle is so fast or what it is, but there was no patience with Rachel Maddow.
Yeah, well, I think we're just running out of patience in general, because this story has dragged on for, it has drip, 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 right, for a year plus, just with the campaign.
Well, plus involved. Plus on the state level, we have Governor Rauner, who has not revealed his taxes too. I mean, he tells you how much, but he shows you the cover page. He doesn't even give you much context of what's going on. So that was a thing that really got under Governor Pat Quinn's craw too, that, you know, we've got this millionaire guy running who knows what, and we don't even know it.
I love that we've gotten to a point in the news cycle that the overrated story, the overreported story is tax returns. It's ridiculous. Ray Long, Heather Sherrone in studio. We'll take a break and get an update on tonight's news from Rob. We'll come back. We'll do the underreported and get to our winners and losers as well. We're reloading this week's news. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's a download, 720 WGN. We're reloading this week's news. Heather Sherrone is City Hall reporter for DNA Info Chicago, and Ray Long, investigative reporter with the Chicago Tribune. We are talking about this week's news, 312-981-7200. If you want to get in on it, you can text, you can call. We've already done the biggest story and overreported. Let's get to the underreported. Heather, what do you got for underreported?
Well, there was the three-year-old boy who was shot in Englewood.
Terrible.
His father was charged today. Apparently, he left him home alone with his siblings, and they were playing cops and robbers, and one of his siblings shot him in the head. And, you know, I've got two little kids. I can't even imagine the pain that entire family must be here. But, you know, as we were saying before we went on the air, it's very similar to the other Englewood case where there was, you know, several kids left home alone in a just dilapidated, dangerous building that had to be raised by the city with, you know, using the stove as heat, which is as dangerous as you can get. And, you know, I think that story didn't really even register is, you know, it's,
I think,
really
the desensitized part of death and violence and little kids is starting to get underreported.
Yeah, unfortunately.
And the way we'll talk, I mean, you'll see newspapers and DNA, you'll report on it, but it's not something that's feeling the outrage. Now, this is a little different story because this is a sibling. This isn't, you know.
It's not random.
I think you right. get more of an outrage if it's a gang member who just is shooting wild and he shoots a three-year-old.
Well, sure, because we all tell right. ourselves, oh, I would never leave my kids home alone with an unsecured weapon. I wouldn't leave them home alone, you know, to begin with, much less with a gun just floating around. But, you know, I can't help but wonder if that's just a story we all tell to make ourselves feel better, and that if we don't, you know, we all lose something because we allow, as a society, you know, we're not collecting. Saying this is unacceptable, what right. are we as a group of people, Chicagoans, going to do?
You know, and what struck me about this too is back in the day, in the 90s, I would be covering all these terrible cases of child neglect, right? If you grew up in Chicago, you remember the Keystone Children,
oh,
right?
Sure.
19 found in squalor. President Clinton compared them to living in Calcutta, right? So we've got all this history here, and we still can't move past the idea that we're finding children in places that, as the police spokesman said, deplorable conditions.
That is a good. That's a, that has to be the number one underreported story. You're right, and again, it was on the front pages of the websites and the newspapers covered it. But like you said, it just didn't get to a point where there was any fervor around what the impact or what was in the story.
I mean, since I cover City Hall, you know, my gauge whether it's accurate or not is, was the mayor forced to talk about it? And he wasn't forced to talk about it because there's, you know, there was, you know, a dozen other things that we needed to ask him about: the Trump budget, healthcare. The police department, I mean, that's a whole other thing that happened this week that, you know, the police revised their, you know, use of force policy, and mm-hmm. police department critics say it's a step backward. So, you know, I got to put myself on the hook there because I could have asked the mayor about it and I didn't because there were other things that, you know, were closer to the top of my mind.
I would put the police reform story as well in underreported. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it had to do with the way that the police department kind of set that up with a late afternoon press conference.
Absolutely.
and everything they did to almost bury the story that wasn't really a story. And I don't know, like, it feels like we're seeing more and more of that even tonight. I mean, the City Hall did a sort of a big news dump at the end of you know, from St. Patrick's Day Friday, talking about some changes to the city council meetings and how much the Cubs cost police officers. So it feels like it's almost, there's a recipe, there's a formula. If you want it underreported, there's a way to go about that.
Well, certainly Friday has always been the big dump day, yeah. right? And that's why the Saturday paper is a great paper to read, too.
Let's because take out, it has all take kinds out the trash stuff. Day.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Ray, what do you got for underreported? Because I agree on this one.
Well, I think it kind of on the national, international stage, it's just now gaining traction, but it's this whole idea that North Korea and the U.S. may get into some kind of conflict here. And, you know, Secretary of State Tillerson basically pulled the plug on negotiations, saying that they didn't work. And so we've got this ramping up of North Korean nuclear missile possibilities here, and all of the United States and its allies, especially in that Asian yeah. area.
Japan, right.
South Korea,
yeah,
they were firing test missiles there just a few days ago, right? And so now you got to start thinking, we're talking about nuclear war here as a possibility.
And again, you know,
that was an underreported story.
Well, and the president tweeted it, and he tweeted about it this morning. And he criticized China for, I'm using air quotes, you know, playing, you know, the whole situation poorly. And, you know, on any other day where you don't have Angela Merkel in the White House, mm-hmm. you know, and
right.
he wouldn't look at her in the Oval Office. He wouldn't shake her hand. You know, it just, any other day that would be the top story. I said this when, the Kim Jong-un's, you know, half-brother was killed in the Malaysian airport with, you know, they believe a nerve agent. And that was the third story on the nightly news
just,
that
there
night.
Is a, I mean, there's, I think North Korea is a desensitized. There's something about the idea that we've heard over and over and over about these missile tests and strange things.
Threats and threats
that I think the American people are like, and it doesn't help. And another thing, too, is Secretary of State Tillerson did not take the normal media people with him on this tour. You know, he only took one conservative website with him, and there, you know, obviously they're still covering it, but
they're not producing daily coverage.
Right. And yeah. I think that yeah. has something to do with the fact that, you know, it is underreported in the way that, you know, this is the first time we've heard the United States talk like this,
yeah,
at least
right.
in the last, I don't know, 15, 20 years. It's like, it's funny that there's one, I just have this mental picture of one journalist going, let me write this down. Am I getting it right?
You did say we could go into a conflict
right,
here, right?
Right, right. Good. I guess trying to get this right because the whole world is watching us.
Yeah, right.
right. So, yeah, so those are the underreported stories.
It's picking up speed. I mean, people are starting to realize what the magnitude of this is.
I also think that it's just a indication of how many different fires are burning right now. You know, you've got healthcare, you've got the budget, you've got Russia, you've got
Twitter.
you know, baseless claims of wiretapping. I mean, so at some point, you know, as a journalist, you've got to say, okay, well, I can write four stories today, yeah. but I don't get to the fifth or the sixth.
It's a fire hose right now, especially if you're in D.C.
Ray Long, Heather Sharon in studio. Okay, so here's what we'll do. We'll do winners and losers when we come back. We'll take a break. We're reloading this week's news, 312-981-7200. Stay with us.
You got copies of stories. Yay. I can just read them
loud. We're just going to read everything. 720 WGN, Justin Kaufman here. Ray Long, the investigative reporter from the Chicago Tribune. Heather Sharon, City Hall reporter at DNA Info. We are reloading this week's news. We are ready for, I guess this would be the lightning round, the winners and losers.
Zoom.
But I have to say, Ray, I mean, you know, the winner has to be Northwestern basketball.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the number
one,
right?
Go UNU.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. I mean, come on. It's an amazing story, and it was fun to watch them squeak out. And it also, I mean, I guess if you say Northwestern's a winner, then Vandy's a loser.
Yeah.
The kid from
and
Vandy.
Let's just not forget to mention that U of I didn't even make the tournament.
Yeah. Right.
If I can, for my own, we had Coach Doug Bruno in here, the DePaul women's basketball team, won today, and they are on to the second round as well.
Excellent.
But, I mean, how great is it? I mean, it's the story of the tournament and at a national level, and you're seeing, you know, from the stars who come out to watch and everything. This was it's a primetime game tomorrow for the Cats and Gonzaga. I mean, you really couldn't draw it up any better.
Right. It's going to be great for recruitment, too. I mean, you get Julia Louise Dreyfus out there screaming and cheering for you, you know. The tube is like putting her on in between
every
shots.
30 seconds.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Ridiculous.
But, that whole deconstruction of the last 2 minutes is like a nightmare for Vanderbilt.
It's going to hurt. Yeah.
And also, I also say that I feel like something has happened to college basketball. Like in a strange way, like the great thing about March Madness is that, you know, it's just like for 30 seconds to go and you're like, here we go.
Yeah.
Now
yeah.
with touches and fouls and looks and this and going over to the screen, it's taking the joy out of the last 30 seconds. I was like, you're ruining this for me. I've been standing next to my TV for 15 minutes now.
Yeah,
like,
that
there's
last
something about
30
there.
Seconds
yeah.
is the, you know, last half hour.
Really. It really is.
But, you know, just imagine what this town or the program at Northwestern would be like if they beat Gonzaga tomorrow.
I mean, it really is. I mean, something to think about. I mean, and I was watching the preview tonight. They had they were talking about the matchup, and Gonzaga has a guy on this squad who's 7'2" that no one can stop.
Yeah.
A big,
yeah.
huge guy. He's like a mountain. They say he's like a mountain.
Yeah.
And I'm just so we like, should enjoy this moment
we
while
should.
It lasts.
I'm glad I'm here.
I think it was last night I told the story of being a kid who I loved the DePaul Blue Demons, and there was a team that made it to the second round, and they got Duke. They got Danny Ferry's Duke.
Oh, man.
And it was like, yeah, it was just all the mantra was as long if we could just keep it at 11. We're down 11. Just keep it at 11.
Yeah. And, you know, like, that was ended up probably before three-pointers, right? You know,
right. So anyway, all right, some other stories. I have Mayor Rahm Emanuel. I felt this week that it was an underreported story as well, and I know, Heather, you covered this. He has been talking about this since Malcolm X College, that he wants to bring the private sector to the table when it comes to violence in Chicago. He comes up with a big score for summer jobs.
Yeah, so 30,000 summer jobs for teens and young adults age 14 to 24, go apply now. The applications are open through May 15th, and this is a major prong of his anti-violence program, because, you know, if you've got something to do, if you've got a goal you're working toward, he said, you know, you're not going to be out there, you know, with a gun, or you're not going to be stealing, you know, you're going to have a sense of yourself, I think is the way that he put it. And, you know, I got to say, I went through the After School Matters when I was a public school high school student. I did the journalism program. That was sort of my first introduction to Chicago journalism. Unfortunately, it's stuck. I haven't been
yeah.
able to.
Rahm may try to cut that out
yeah.
now. I
haven't been able to get out of it since. But, you know, he also is doing this on his own. Let's be clear about
yes,
that. It's
that's
only
the big
city.
Story.
It's
yeah.
only city money. There's no state money because
no
we've
feds.
Talked about the state problem, and there's no federal money. And, you know, I wrote a ton of stories about all of Trump's tweets to the mayor about what, you know, terrible job he's doing about Chicago violence. And the mayor went to D.C. and said, OK, here's what you can do. And one of the things he said was, I need money for after school jobs. I need money for summer jobs. The federal government has not responded.
Well, I mean, it's a big win for Mayor Emanuel to step up, and with all of the political strife that Illinois is in and the federal government pointing, for him to twist the arms of the private sector to say, we're doing this together. It's a big win.
And it's 2,000 jobs of those 30,000 jobs that are set aside for high-risk students. And part of the people who get those jobs will also get mentoring and mental health counseling services. So, you know, the idea is that if you can get those 2,000 kids sort of moving in the right direction, you solve problems before they start.
Ray, what do you think?
Well, we'll see if it works. I mean, this is the big test, right? It's not small numbers. We're not looking at one small neighborhood. We're looking at a possibility of things happening all throughout the city. And, you know, it's one of those deals where FDR used to say, if we have a problem, we'll try something. If that doesn't work, we'll try something else. So that is kind of what we've got to do with the violence issue. And this is one thing he's jumping.
It's all like one big puzzle when you talk about the Trump budget and really saying that, you know, private sector is going to have to step up. And we've seen it with Rauner as well, where it's just like private sector will take on some of these things. Yeah. Rahm Emanuel, in a forced way, had to do that and did. So there we go. Losers. All right. So what do we have for losers? I think we already said the kid from Vanderbilt, which we don't want to even say. I feel bad. He's an 18-year-old kid, 19-year-old kid. But
well, the Secret Service did not have a great week. So man breached the security perimeter at the White House. We learned tonight he was loose on the grounds for 17 minutes. He actually shook the handle of the entrance to the presidential residence.
There's no zapper on that thing.
Yeah, like, we're like shaking our heads here, right?
And then, of course, a Secret Service agent in New York lost a laptop with schematics of Trump Tower and apparently information related to the email probe of Hillary Clinton. I'm honestly not sure.
That's the one that I'm not even sure what that means. Yeah.
That's going to show up in my mailbox any day.
Any day.
Tribune Tower, 435.
The best part about that is that whoever stole that is this probably some kid who's just like,
he's
not
probably already moved.
He's trying to play Minecraft
he's like, how do I load this app on here? Yeah, like he has no concept of what anything's on there. Let's hope. Yeah. Or like I said earlier, it's a beginning plot line to a 24 episode.
Well,
so I
did hear that they have the ability to wipe it remotely. So I imagine they have in fact already done that.
I hope so. Right. It's on somebody's to-do list.
The whole security thing at the White House though is troubling because they've had breaches before. They had it under Obama before Obama too, but you know, come on. It makes you think that these kinds of movies that you've seen where people go over the fence, you know, could very well happen.
Yeah. I guess you put this in losers, the Rauner Madigan poll this week saying both of them are trending in the negative numbers. I mean, I guess the only thing to pull from that story is, well, I mean, it's equal hate.
Rauner's hate has some velocity, it seems, right now.
Yeah.
Although Madigan still has the lead, and whether we're kind of at the halfway point of the race here to 2018.
Right. Well, okay.
Well, and there's still no agreement for the Chicago public schools, who may have to end classes June 1st as opposed to June 20th. Rauner made another proposal this week that the Democrats didn't sort of greet with open arms. That I think will be the big story if we're looking
and,
ahead.
And it's interesting. That's an interesting story. The city actually trying to block the Chicago Teachers Union, trying to do a one-day strike on May 1st. I mean, it seems like the same storyline just coming back and just it's just I feel like I'm in some sort of loop.
Well, you know? How do you think they feel in Springfield? Yeah. It is Groundhog Day on steroids down there.
All right. All right, we come back.
Maybe
they're all losers.
I know, but you're right. I mean, at a certain point, like you have these moments where you're like, I think we are living in the Matrix, that these stories are just repeating themselves. And you're like, I think there's a glitch. I'm recognizing myself.
Do we take the blue pill?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
It's Westworld, man. Right. We live in Westworld.
Right.
But it's mundane state politics. That's the Westworld we live in. All right,
rabbit hole.
Yeah, the rabbit hole coming up after the break. We'll do what story sucked us down the rabbit hole, and also which story we'll remember from this week in 5 years, 10 years, 500 years from now. It's the download. We're reloading this week's news. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's the download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. We're reloading this week's news with Heather Sharon. She is the City Hall reporter for DNA Info Chicago. Ray Long, investigative reporter for Chicago Tribune. Longtime bureau chief down at Springfield. We have got through biggest story, overreported, underreported, winners and losers. It's time for the story that really grabbed us, that sucked us down the rabbit hole. Ray, you and I share one. I didn't really get a story. Mine was Facebook comments.
Yeah.
But it was very similar to the idea that, you know, the, a lot of what came out of the Trump budget was what's going to happen to artists.
Right. And it's important to a town like Chicago that is so rooted in community and community arts and the whole idea of putting theater out there or having outdoor performances or just bringing arts to the community, whether it's painting or whether it's bands or whatever it is. It's part of the fabric of Chicago.
It's also economic development.
Right.
You can't tell me that, you know, Hamilton hasn't been a huge driver of visits, you know, because that show's been sold out every night since it opened since September, and it's, you know, sold out at least, you know, for the next year. You know, we, it's just amazing.
They could run it 24 hours a day.
So, you know, it's not just,
I got tickets at 7 o'clock in the morning.
But so it's not just, you know, what I like to think of as, you know, floofy, feel good. Everybody likes to paint and, you know, art is nice. You know, this is, you know, really, it's jobs. You know what I mean? It's, you know, the people who feed the art. It's the people who feed the artists. It's people who feed the people who go to the shows. It's the bars near the, you know, galleries.
And think about the movies that are in the TV shows that have been coming
Well,
into,
all of those
in
fit
Chicago.
Into the I mean, what I was, I think it was the Facebook comments on the Tribb story, Howard Wright's story about
a tremendous
abolished
story,
culture
putting it
or whatever
together.
It was. You know, and it was nuanced. I mean, you have some on there that are just, you know, go Trump or go, or, you know, go
we
jump in the lake Trump.
We got to set priorities.
Right? But, there was an argument and one that I've heard, and I don't know if I have the answer to, which is this idea that if it's great art, it'll survive without government funding, that we should get, the government should be out of the business of funding the arts. This is something that's new to our society. Mm-hmm. I mean, it wasn't until this, I think they said the 80s even, the 60s or the 70s or 80s, one of those decades where we started to subsidize the arts, that as human beings and societies, we've had arts that have survived without government subsidies. Yeah. I mean, I think about it in my head. And then on the other side, you get the argument that says, well, listen, this isn't big money.
Yes.
Stop acting like this is millions and millions of dollars. The false sort of equivalency of what do I say to coal miners when I, you know, about Corporation for Public Broadcasting. That's not, they're not the same. We're talking about minuscule numbers
about cents per person per year.
And so how important are the arts to our society is the first question. Then the second question is, if they're that important, if you can make that argument, is there a role for the government to essentially deliver help?
Right, and it's the question of whether you want to subsidize different voices, just like different artists or poets. You've got different types of sounds. It kind of reminds me of the time when public TV and public radio first came on the air, right? We're saying we're hearing all this concert music that we'd never heard before because we've been listening to the Beatles or whoever. When, I'm dating myself there, but that is about the time that it changed, and then you were opened to a whole different world, and public radio, no doubt, has opened up the world view of many people to hear all kinds of a variety of shows, and same for public TV, that you wouldn't have, and you may not have if you shut off.
There was
off
a
the
great
money.
Quote that's going around Facebook, a great site if you guys haven't been on it. It's great.
10 out of 10 would
really
recommend.
Great, really great. Very talented. But there's a great quote of Mr. Rogers testifying to the Senate hearing about public TV. And he says that, you know, right now it takes a 2%. This was the 70s. He was talking about maybe even earlier. The idea of, like, listen, the percentage it takes, you know, an NEA grant gives us $6,000. That's enough for 2 minutes of a cartoon. And the cartoons are, you don't want the cartoons because they have, you know, whatever, they're bashing over people, kids over the head. We teach them about little things like the I think he called it inner child drama, about haircuts, about fights with siblings, about adjusting to family situations. Things that, you know, the people who are making cartoons on the Cartoon Network, it's not necessarily their bag to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the question becomes, you make more money if you make cartoons. So the idea that the market will figure it out, well, the market has figured it out and said those things are not valuable. You can't make money off them. So therefore, they don't exist.
Mm-hmm. Well,
that's the problem. I have a problem with that.
I mean, it's also, you know, in a weird way, elitist, because, you know, wealthy people will find quality programming for their children. You know, they'll buy a subscription to Netflix. They'll do whatever needs to be done.
It's the argument of HBO, Sesame Street going HBO, right?
So, you know, it's not going to be me, essentially, that would suffer, or my kids, but it would be the people, the coal miner or the single mom in Detroit, like the president said, who doesn't have that discretionary income and whose kids wouldn't have access to Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood or Sesame Street or Word Girl or Super Y. I know a lot about children's programming.
Wow.
So, but again, it's like, right. it's a value, you know, what do we value as a society?
What
you know
mayor
what I mean?
Said earlier, yeah.
And, you know, I think that for a lot of people, perhaps on the left side of the political world, in some ways, we thought those questions were settled. You know what I mean? Like, we had those debates with Mr. Rogers. You know, we funded the arts. You know, right. But now, I think, like you said, right, yeah. the paradigm has shifted. And
right.
those questions are up for grabs again. So I think that's why there were all those Facebook comments. Because people are sort of asking themselves these questions in a way I don't think that we've asked ourselves
and
in
the,
about
and the
a
one,
decade.
And the piece that's missing, it always gets me, is that to be an artist... to give that back to our society, to paint mm-hmm. a mural on this and make your neighborhood a better place, and to it has effect on the people in the community.
Sure.
And the money that you're making, you're not making $190,000, $180,000,
right.
$70,000. You're not getting benefits. You're making $20,000, $25,000, $30,000, and a lot of times nobody wants to pay for that. So that's where we've come up with social programs to say that this is worth something to our community, to our neighborhood. So that's to me, I get the concept that, hey, you know what, at a certain point the government has changed in the world that we can't afford to, as a society, fund everything.
Well, yeah, there's and that's the context too. You can't just be throwing money again and again and again out the door. You actually have to pay for that. And because our officials at state, local, and national level have not figured out that you can only spend so much, they have put all this money into all these different things, and that opens up the ability for somebody to come in like Trump and slam the door on it and say, hey, we got to get it under control, and then have some sort of an argument to buttress his own argument.
We've seen over and over arts being considered extracurricular.
Right.
We've seen it in schools. It starts in schools. I mean, mm-hmm. how many times we grew up maybe with an arts program or an arts class, but so many schools, when they get close to having to cut a budget, art's the first thing to go.
Arts,
now,
music.
We're seeing it happen again now with we talk about federal funding. I mean, what is it with our society where we continually believe or go back to this question of whether or not the arts are important?
You know, it seems discretionary. You know what I mean? Like, I can't eat a painting. You know?
Sure.
I can't, it's not going to keep me warm on a cold night. So there's a part of our, I don't know, caveman brain that says that's a want instead of a need.
Of course, if we're talking about nuclear war with North Korea, yes. you know, you eliminate some of your extras,
yes,
too.
Yes, yes, yeah, right. yes, indeed.
Well, the other story I had, and we'll get to it quick because I want to get to the last category as well, is I went down the rabbit hole, and I still have a long way to go, on the mixed income fight over the Jefferson Park, the neighborhood northwest side of Chicago. They want to build a building, their seven-story building, that the alderman had suggested would have 80 units that would be for mixed income for Section 8, as we knew it, or low income.
Well, it would be subsidized housing. And in my previous life, before I covered City Hall, I covered Jefferson Park. And it's, you know, a really big debate about what Jefferson Park should be, because you're having people priced out of Logan Square and Wicker Park who are looking up the blue line and saying, you know, where can I find a little bit more space? Where can I find a little bit more
right.
cheaper rent? And they're sort of running into people who have lived in Jefferson Park for decades, who bought a bungalow, who have a single family home, and who really sort of feel like they're holding on to their little piece of the American dream by their fingernails. And the Alderman Arena, he supports this new development, which would include a self-storage facility, and that was actually approved by the Plan Commission this week, as well as 100 units that would be developed by a low-income housing developer designed to help people who are being pushed out of Logan Square, pushed out of Wicker Park, and also pushed out of Jefferson
and that's
Park.
And that's the controversy, because there are groups that are coming out that'll say, well, you know, this is going to change the character. We don't like these big buildings. We don't need
stories. We don't want it four stories. Right. We want it three stories.
Right. But then the underlying thought, and which gets pulled out a lot, is this really just about not in my neighborhood?
If you say Section 8 on the Northwest Side, that is code straight up for I'm worried about African American and Latinos moving into this area. I heard it all the time. And, you know, the Northwest Side is the same neighborhood, I'm sure Ray remembers this, where Harold Washington went to campaign at St. Pascal's and was greeted with racist graffiti. You know, this is not an area of the city that has, you know, sort of a history of sort of being easily integrated.
Right.
And this is sort of, I think, an economic story as well as sort of, you know, a cultural story or a race story, because this neighborhood is sort of, you know, is in the midst of a change. Like, is it part of the suburbs or is it part of the city? Okay, well, it's technically part of the city, but there are a lot of people who live there who like the fact it's a little bit suburban, but they're still close to the blue line.
It's a fascinating story about the city. I mean, you look at all neighborhoods, it's a microcosm of what a lot of neighborhoods have gone through, and also a strange political story with Alderman John Arena and his perennial challenger, and I forgot his
name. John Garrido,
who continually challenges it for alderman, who is the face and voice of this movement to push back on the alderman in this project.
It's really fascinating because in 2011, Arena won his seat on the council by 30 votes. Like, if you don't think voting matters, like, talk to Alderman Arena, 30 votes. And then so John Garrido ran again in 2015 and I think was, you know, certain that he was going to give the alderman a run for his money, and he did. He forced a runoff, but Arena won by almost 1,500 votes. And so that's, you know,
and those two have had like run-ins. Like,
yes.
I think there's history.
Yes,
there's
not a lot of love lost there.
And it's interesting too that your political opponent also becomes the voice of the residents in this way. That especially when you're talking about issues of gentrification and race, I mean, there's a lot going on in Jefferson Park that again mirrors what Chicago.
And I
has
should
gone
mention
through.
That, you know, Alderman Arena is a very progressive Democrat on the city council. He supported Bernie Sanders in the presidential election. You know, he is not a supporter typically of Rahm Emanuel, the sort of the centrist Democrats, whereas John Garrido ran for Cook County Board President as a Republican. Now, he would tell you city council races are nonpartisan. I'm neither a Republican nor a Democrat, but I think that, you know, people that matters to
that's
people.
That's a good story.
There's a little establishment versus firebomber type of attitude there, and people are taking sides.
Absolutely.
Ray Long, Heather Sharon in studio. All right, we'll take a break. We'll get our last segment in where we'll find out what story we're going to remember from this week in 5 years, 10 years, 500 years from now. What are they going to write on the cave when we go back to caves? They'll write the story.
Nuclear winner.
Yeah, nuclear, exactly. Don't give it away. All right, it's a download. Stay with us. All right, we're reloading this week's news here on the download. I'm Justin Kaufman, 312-981-7200. Ray Long, Heather Sharon, here all evening. I enjoy it. Thank you so much for
Lots
being
of
here.
Fun.
Happy to
Ray,
be here.
Ray, of course, an investigative reporter with the Tribune. Heather is a City Hall reporter for DNA Info. You can check out both their stuff. They're working all the time. That's the good news. That's why they're here on St. Patrick's Day night.
That's right.
They just work.
That's right.
They still got stories to file
That's
tonight.
Right.
All right, so the final category tonight, which story from this week will be remembered in, I don't know, a year, 5 years, 10 years, 500 years from now. Let's start with you, Ray. What do you want to take a stab at? What do you think is going to be the story?
Yeah, I think it'll be a time capsule of this show. Actually, I think we have covered the fears and worries and hopes and dreams of the people of Alzheimer's. But you know, I think that the one that has the potential here, there's two actually. Obviously, I talked about as the underreported, and that was the idea that we could be at a point where we're breaking off negotiations with North Korea over nuclear weapons, but also the idea that we could be turning our backs on the Great Lakes without restoring the funding that they expected.
Ooh, that's a good one.
Yeah,
I didn't even think about that. That's strong. It could be like in 100 years. Remember when we had water?
Yeah, right, right. We didn't have to like sift through it. Or
I mean, I don't want to take up all the time, but the idea that Chicago and our world, I mean, we just saw just sure. last year that there were droughts in California. We're right. like, well, everyone's going to have to move to the Great Lakes. The idea that you take any money away from funding is so head-scratcher.
Uh-huh. Well, what's interesting is the mayor spent a good deal of time this week talking about the river, and he is sort of pitching it as the second waterfront, and there are new towers going up along the river, and he really sort of wants to showcase that. And the Riverwalk, you know, if you haven't gone, it's great on a beautiful day. You know, you can get a drink and sort of watch the world go by. Mm-hmm. You know, we all joke about the river not really being something you want to touch or get up close to, but that's not really true anymore. You know, when, you know, 20 Absolutely, years ago, there right. were 7 species in the river. Now there are close to 70 species in the river. It's significantly cleaner because of those programs that are on the chopping block, you know, under the president's budget. You know, and, you know, I when I was a kid, the river smelled, you know what right. I mean? Like, there were lots more jokes about on St. Patrick's Day, they would dye it blue, you know, instead of dyeing it green because it was always green.
Right.
You know, I don't know that people remember how bad it was. And that those
back,
programs
right.
were, you know, yeah. sort of what made the difference.
It's the Cuyahoga River catching on fire.
Right.
Yeah, we don't need
Ohio.
Any of that.
No, we don't need that.
All right, Heather, what do you think? What do you think people are going to remember in 500 years?
I think I agree with Ray in a little bit. I think, you know, getting back to the question of the arts, I think that in many, many different respects, President Trump's administration will be a defining moment in that we will, as a society, have to decide, you know, what kind of people are we? You know, right. are we a people who support arts? Are we a people who take care of the environment? You know, are we a people who fund things other than nuclear weapons? Because, you know, I think the one, you know, so, you know, President Trump's budget is sort of a, you know, it shifts all of the domestic spending to military spending. And, you know, is that what our priority right. is as a people? I don't know the answer to that question, but it will be fascinating to sort of
In 500 years, there's going to be a black market for paintings. Do you want drugs? No, I'm looking for a painting.
Yeah. All
right, here's
beauty, give me the beauty.
mine will be a little bit of a prediction. I will say this week will be remembered for the week that the Northwestern Wildcats knocked off the number one seed.
They'll still be undefeated
yeah,
after 500
years. They're gonna win tomorrow.
And journalists everywhere
yep.
will be insufferable.
We're gonna go crazy. This will be everyone will remember this week. It'll be the week that they won their first game of the tournament that they ended up winning. All the way, winning it all, and we'll remember it.
Oh, that's a homer. Yeah, you've gone totally homer with us here. But I like
it. It could happen. Ray Long, Heather Sharon. Thanks, you guys. It was a great great night reloading this week's news. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having
Thank
us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rob. Download here on 720 WGN on this beautiful St. Patrick's Day night here in the Chicagoland area. Got real nice outside. You know, like earlier today, it was a little, you know, you could see the ice turning slushy. And then you get to around 9. It's nice. I don't get a chance. I haven't been outside, I don't think, since like 3 o'clock. But I feel like just watching the revelers
mm-hmm.
on Michigan Avenue, they're jacketless. In some cases, or light jacket. We're not seeing the gloves and hats.
Very nice. Although,
uh-oh.
A mild St. Patrick's Day evening doesn't bode well for my commute home tonight. I have a feeling that it's going to be a little ugly.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's a tough one. Are you going to public transit it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. A red line up.
So you redlined at Grand, right? Or
mm-hmm.
right in that area? Yeah. Because that's like going to be the stop for this area down the Clubbard
mm-hmm,
Street kind
mm-hmm,
of stuff, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think, like, you get a bunch of people beyond there that might be drunk.
And loud and obnoxious,
loud and
yeah.
singing and things like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, right. I, you know.
And you got to go right to Wrigleyville.
Yep. Might pick up a couple more. It, you know, because yeah, like I don't mind like the homeless,
right?
You know, other than the smell occasionally, but they're quiet. They're just
right.
sleeping there.
Right.
I'm sitting on my phone. You're not bothering me. But then yeah, you get the
when you get up on Wrigleyville, you need to get your steely gaze This guy's kind of like a Bernard Goetz type. I don't want to mess with this guy. You know what I mean? Like, you got to look like there might be a screw loose.
Yeah.
Then you're fine.
It could be some sort of subway vigilante, if you will.
I think I have a costume pair of, like, yellow shaded sunglasses, you know, that I've used for different things. I'll give you those. You could wear those, taxi driver kind of thing.
Yeah. That'll do the trick. Yeah. Well, but you'll see him, like, walk in and then, woo! Or like turn around, like go to the next car.
We got a vigilante. Yeah, we need to get you like a VHS tape of a Charles Bronson movie. You ever seen? I had a chance to see a Charles Bronson movie recently. I forgot what one it was, but I kind of missed. I was interested to see if it held up, and it absolutely doesn't. Like in the way that you're just, it does. It does in a way that you're like, wow, that's very early 80s. But also at the same time, you're like, this is terrible, like everything about it. It's essentially like a band. The movie is just a band of like guys who are like got a boombox, who are in New York or whatever. And they're just like, bam, 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 bam. They're like break dancers type stuff, but they're also rapists. Oh. Like it's like a double thing. Like they dance, but then they're also troublemakers. Uh-huh. So Bronson like comes up
taking
on him.
Taking it in his own hands.
Yeah, he takes the whole crew down. I just thought it was like a mix between... I was like, well, they're really sort of stereotyping the urban environment here. Like, these guys will breakdance, and then they'll stab you in the neck.
And marginally racist.
Oh, marginally. Yeah. I don't know about that. I go full on that. But it's just like, I just remember, it's like one of the guys had a boombox and, like, cool, like, weird Max Headroom kind of sunglasses on. So you're like, that's the villain.
Yeah, they need to take that guy down a notch.
Yeah.
Dancing and whatnot. Can't be dancing.
Speaking of, you know, as much as I love the, I thought it was funny, like watching the Northwestern game yesterday. The Northwestern Wildcats, of course, have all the star power. Julia Louis-Dreyfus, Doug Collins. I don't know if that's Chris Collins' wife that's next to him that was jumping up and down. I don't know if there was Doug Collins. I don't know who
Doug Collins' was. Wife, maybe, Doug Collins' wife.
But it was just like amazing to watch. Like, there's a point, like, I blink where I'm like, this is like, as a Chicagoan, I'm like, I guess these are the people who represent us, like on the national stage, because we're never in this tournament. And I guess Northwestern, you know, I guess you do judge a little bit by who goes to the school.
Yeah.
But it was funny. Like, I was like, this is Chicago. The woman who's a primetime winner on Veep and the former Bulls coach whose son, I was like, we're like a celebrity town.
Yeah.
Like we were like the LA Lakers.
Yeah.
In a way.
When I was watching, I was thinking like, oh man, I'm sure Seth Meyers wishes he could be there because they'd be showing him.
Was he not there?
I didn't see it. They didn't show him.
I'll bet he shows up in Salt Lake tomorrow.
They didn't show
him.
If
he doesn't, he's not using NBC's resources properly. That's an easy sell to the marketing department. Can I get the jet? Because I'm going to be on CBS, right?
Yeah.
Or True TV or whatever they put it. But the point being, you know, I'm going to get some stage time. I'm going to get some FaceTime.
Yeah.
For our network and our show.
They probably wouldn't. There's Seth Meyers. He used to be on Saturday Night Live. Yeah. I don't know what he's doing now. Don't forget to watch James Corden at 11:30.
They'd be like, the new Superior Donuts. It's so funny. You're going to love it. It's so funny. You got to watch it. Please? I hate those reads, those Billy Packer kind of reads or whatever it is. It's fun to watch college basketball again. I got to say, I haven't watched much of that. We've heard a lot. We heard all the games here on 720. But I haven't watched that environment for like a little bit, like a month or two. And it was fun to watch like the announcers and the whole bit.
Yeah.
They really get into the basketball like sort of breakdown. I really love it with the college kids. They're just like, what's this kid thinking? Like I was watching, I think it was the Northwestern post game. With Barkley and Smith and all those guys.
Yeah, Ernie.
It was really interesting. It wasn't Ernie. It was
Greg Dumble, maybe.
Dumble and he takes
Clark
Kellogg, too,
mm-hmm.
where everyone just talks over each other for 15 minutes. And you're like, I think they said Northwestern in there. I don't know. But their breakdown was like you're watching the Houston Rockets and Dallas Mavericks. Like, they a couple times they said they're kids, you know, that's whatever. But at a certain point, you're like, man, they're just like breaking it down like this team screwed up.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I have a funny story. A week ago, probably 2 weeks ago, longer, I was talking about my son and how he missed that moment when the Wildcats are playing the Michigan Wolverines. And the Cats beat them at the buzzer. They threw that thing. I remember told a story where I was had the game on, and I was like, okay. My son was sitting there. He's on his iPad. And I go, hey, this is a great opportunity. This is sports 101. There's 1 second to play. If they make the basket, they go. They win the game. If they lose, if they don't make it, they go to overtime. Watch this with me. So he kind of puts his head, takes his head up. You know, the play happens. I turn around, like, oh my god, it happened! I turn around, and he's got his head in the iPad, like he just blew the whole thing.
Could last one second.
And then I told the story, and there's some people who text in like, "Your son's the problem with society."
Yeah,
you know, I was like, "All right, okay, it's okay." And I don't think we're going to make or break society on whether or not he likes a regular season Big Ten college basketball game. But yesterday, we started late, so I had a chance to pick him up. And it was really funny because he said it's a strange question to ask, but he goes, "Hey, so what happened? It was exciting today." That's what he said. I was like, "What?" Like, that, I think that's what his mom asks him every day, and I think he just asked me. So anyway, I go, "Well, the Northwestern Wildcats, they won their game. They beat they won their first game ever. They got to the NCAA tournament, March Madness, and it worked out." And he goes, "Hey, Dad. Is that the team where they threw the ball the entire way and then the guy caught it and scored at the end?" And I'm like, "What?" And he's like, "The game, remember?" And I'm like, "Yes! Yes, it's the same team!"
You remember.
Yeah, and he goes, "Yes!" And I was like, "You're into it! You're in! We're turning this around!" I'm like, "They play on Saturday. You want to watch?" He's like, "Yeah." I'm like, "Yes! That's it is! Better than a no!" So now I feel like I have to go out tomorrow and like to the party favor store and get a bunch of purple stuff.
Yeah.
Like maybe get some the foods he likes, which would be like plain cheese, you know, whatever. Just like anything that makes the experience.
Nothing's better with cheese. Don't say anything bad about cheese.
No, of course not. But just to make the experience, you know, I want to draw out as much energy as I can from that experience.
Well, you're going to have to start bright and early tomorrow.
Yeah.
Like start feeding the beast.
I'm going to do the same thing, being like...
Things will go on, and he'll lose interest in the morning.
Yeah. Yeah, you're absolutely
right.
So
just get him excited right from when he wakes up.
I remember when I was a kid, I really obsessed about DePaul Blue Demon basketball. You know, it's like the tail end. I was on the tail end of the 70s. It was like early 80s, so you had Terry Cummings and Mark McGuire.
Yeah, they were the game in town.
And then, you know, it was they had the Dallas Comedies, Mark Strickland, or Rod Strickland, game where... and then they used to show DePaul on Channel 9 all the time, right? So you got to watch them play in their conference, and they played Georgetown or whatever, and it was like a great Sunday afternoon game. So I was really into it, and I remember I would write up, my dad would make me write up the games like I was a reporter. So I'd like have to explain what happened in the game, you know, it's like kind of a moment. And it was kind of fun to do that, right? And so there's joy in those memories. Right, there's joys around DePaul basketball. I've told the story 2 days in a row now of like the idea of remembering Danny Ferry and the Duke Blue Devils just romping on the Demons. And it was a late game; it was a 10 o'clock game, one of those games. I was just like, they're not going to win this game. Like, it was just like, oh, they're not going to win this game. And but like, you just got to keep it in with 11. So like, I want him to have that experience. So there's almost like. I obviously, because I lived it and it's something that I enjoyed, and I still positively talk about that experience. So I want it to be, so I got to do it right. I think I'm just going to do a David and Goliath type story.
Yeah.
Right?
Who doesn't like that?
Yeah, right. That's a classic. He's going to understand that. And I'll be like, you know, there's these guys from California, you know?
Gonzaga is from Washington, first of all.
Spokane, Washington. That's where Gonzaga's from. I always thought they were like a Northern California team. So anyway, I'll tell them they're from Washington. I'll tell my son, I'll say, listen, they're big guys from Washington, like that big guy, that 7'2" guy in the middle. These guys are born with silver spoons in their mouth. These are basketball factory, right? Everyone in the country, including the president, Donald Trump, believes Gonzaga is going to win this game. Don't you want to see Northwestern pull a Cinderella, right?
That's the way to do it.
Right. Gonzaga is like the ugly stepsisters. They're trying to shove their foot into the slipper, right? That's the same. That's the right story. Yeah. Something. I'm still working on it. I'm working on trying to find the right. But I like this. This is where I think I'm going to go all day. This is what I'm going to. This is the message I'm going to try to hit. That can. And then when the game's close, when it's 2-0, 4-0, then I can keep his interest by being like, "Can you believe it? We're up."
Yeah. There were a lot of games yesterday from, you know, like 16-1 games that were, I think Villanova might have been tied or only up by 2 at half.
Okay. So
there's a couple of games that were like tied at half. They ended up losing by 20, you know.
Right.
They
went like my winning. Guys from Northern Kentucky are now down 15.
It happens quick.
It does.
But yeah, if you could get like a solid first half.
I need a solid first half that goes into my storyline, my narrative. You know Brian McIntosh? You see that kid? That kid lost his tooth just like you did. Something like that.
Anything,
you know, I'm just trying to think. I don't know anything about Brian McIntosh, but I'm like, you know, he also loves cheese. Something where...
Well, you might have to do some research. Yeah, you can look it up.
I'm not going to lie. I may have to Wikipedia this. I may have to Wikipedia the facts around the Cats-Zags game tomorrow. I'm psyched, man. I'm psyched. I feel like I've already laid the groundwork too. Because you know what? If you're not my wife's not a big sports fan. I'm not. So we've come to sort of an agreement that the casual sports, the stuff that I'm not really that into, college basketball comes to mind, especially when it's not a team you're. So the last couple of years has been great because there's none. I don't watch
around,
it because
it
doesn't matter. Like, so I can then go double down on the Bears.
That's,
you know,
that's
or the
fair,
Hawks.
That's fair,
you know, like
that's
the thing where I'm like, hey, there's a playoff game. You same with the Cubs World Series, something like that. Right. But, you know, I will then sort of be like, you know, we don't need to watch the White Sox regular season game on Saturday night.
Right.
You know, I don't need to watch that. So this is one of those where I had to do some explaining today where I'm like, this is the first time that this sport is going to have that kind of intensity to it, you know. Because yesterday's game was during the day. She was at work, but this will be a Saturday, 4:15 start, right in the middle of like.
Yeah, this is big.
You know, opposite Men in Black 2 on HBO. So there's a lot. There's a lot riding. All right, coming up, we'll take a break here. We'll come back. We'll get Rob's news, and then coming up, Charlie Newell's going to join us, the artistic director at the Court Theater in Hyde Park, also the director of The Hard Problem, the newest Tom Stoppard play. It's just about to open, and it's the Court Theater, so you know it's going to be good. So Charlie Newell will talk about his life in theater and the Hard Problem coming up. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My next guest, one of the Chicago Theater's most treasured artists. Charles Newell is the artistic director at the Court Theater in Hyde Park. Newell is currently directing The Hard Problem, the latest play from writer Tom Stoppard, runs through April 9th. Newell has worked alongside some of the greats, Tom Stoppard, as mentioned, Tony Kushner, other playwrights, as well, he's going to be directing Arthur Miller's play All My Sons next season. Newell's been the artistic director at the Court for 23 years. He's directed more than 50 productions, including Secret Garden, Tartuffe, Proof, Angels in America, just to name a few. And he's been nominated for 16 Jeff Awards, and that's just for directing. In 2012, Newell was honored by the League of Chicago Theaters with the Artistic Achievement Award. And Charlie Newell's my guest tonight at the big table. Charlie, good to see you. Thanks for being here.
It's a pleasure, Justin. Thanks for
having
me. Big
fan of yours. All right, so let's talk about the hard. Let's start with The Hard Problem. I mean, I've always known the name Tom Stoppard. I've always known it to be a great playwright. I have to say, I don't know much beyond the name. Tell us what makes a Tom Stoppard play a Tom Stoppard play.
Well, you know, Tom's work is recognized as being both a combination of a dazzling wit, engaging in highly sophisticated intellectual inquiry, and yet as an audience member, you don't have to know anything about it, and yet you feel like you're getting it as it's happening.
Well, that's good, right?
And the work, in my experience with him, has been, if as director, can we find what is there but is sometimes hard to locate, which is the heart, the emotion, is what we traffic best in the theater. And so when you find the combination of those three things, I think that's when it really
works.
Do
you find yourself gravitating to artists, to playwrights like that, like Tom Stoppard, who can bring that kind of combination that you mentioned?
Well, I am the artistic director of the Court Theater, the professional theater of the University of Chicago. So, yes, we certainly do a lot of very intellectually challenging work. But, you know, I, like most people, go to the theater because I want to be moved. I want to feel something. I want to connect. And that's when you can work with such heightened language. I love heightened verse, et cetera. Stoppard has some of his plays, not this one, that is in a kind of a formal structure of language. But this play deals with all kinds of issues of psychology, neuroscience, biology, philosophy. I mean, he crams it all in together. And actually famously said, yeah, I want to write a play about, you know, the financial crisis of 2007 and 8. And I want to write a play about, you know, the hard problem in philosophy. Oh, well, I guess I'll do a play which I'll put them both in it. So this play has been just an absolute joy.
You've had the good fortune of being able to not only produce and direct plays from some outstanding playwrights, American playwrights, but you've worked with them. Collaborated with them. What's your relationship like with a playwright, especially famous ones like a Tom Stoppard or Tony Kushner? Talk about that relationship being a theater in Chicago with some of the great playwrights that we've seen in our time.
Well, I'm the luckiest man in showbiz to be able to have those relationships. With Tom, it began back when the Goodman Theater asked me to direct his other most recent play, Rock and Roll, I think in 2009, if I'm not mistaken. And it was through that where I reached out to him, and he was very open to me calling him in the middle of previews and saying, hey, we got the laugh on that line. What do you think? And he wanted to change some of the ending of that play from its Broadway premiere. And so similarly, when I went to London in 2015, wanted to see his newest play. It was sold out because it was a Tom Stoppard play. So I called him up. He says, oh, I'll get you house seats. So I was able to see The Hard Problem there in its premiere. And then he was very instrumental in helping us secure the Chicago premiere rights to do the play here because of our relationship.
It's surprising to hear that a playwright, especially coming off of Broadway or run in London, would be thinking about tinkering at all with the play. That happens?
That definitely happens. And, I mean, Tony Kushner is sort of both infamously, notoriously, wonderfully, is that he's always rewriting, even in Angels in America. But with Tom, what was thrilling is after the premiere in London, there's been production in Philadelphia, San Francisco, Washington, D.C., and in each iteration with those directors and those productions, he did provide some further tinkering. I had the opportunity, again, I just feel so fortunate, where for the weeks of rehearsal, he and I were on the phone frequently from London, from his estate outside of London in Dorset, in which I was able to ask him any question I had, and he was the most generous.
How about that?
I mean, because he's a theater guy, you know what I mean? He's like, of course, before the first phone call, I was a little nervous, but then we immediately just got into, how does it work, and what did you think, and how do you intend, and this is my thought, and he try that, Charlie, and get back to me, and that laugh never worked for me, maybe you can make it work, you know, stuff like that. So he's a theater man through his blood, although he's obviously done a lot of film and other work, but he just loves the process. He talks about his writing is one thing, but it's not until it's in the rehearsal room, in the theater, does it become an event. And that's what he loves. So talking to him about how are we creating this event in Chicago, he's been most generous.
Do you see it the same way? Do you see your shows and your performances as events?
Well, are you talking to me as the artistic director or as the director? Because I sort of think of them in different ways.
I put on both. Let's do one as the artistic director and one as director.
Well, I mean, that's one of the things that here in Chicago, we have such a vibrant, incredible theater community and theater-going audience that in order to get some attention to the show that you're doing, one must create a sense of event about it. And so clearly we're doing the Chicago. I mean, how lucky are we that Chicago is going to get to see a brand new Tom Stoppard play? I mean, he's 80 years old. That's not going to happen in too many more times. And so this sense of an event to the Chicago premiere as artistic director and producer person is thrilling. We also try to create events like we did in the new play about Louis Armstrong, Satchmo at the Waldorf, where we did all kinds of music events, gallery events, literature events around the production. So you're not simply coming to see the show. You're actually kind of getting immersed in the whole larger questions around the play. We're doing something similar with that with the Stoppard play, and it's been thrilling.
Charlie Newell is my guest. He's the artistic director at the Court Theater, also the director of The Hard Problem, the new, the latest Tom Stoppard play, which is on stage at the Court in Hyde Park through April 9th. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back. Charlie Newell, my guest. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest in studio, Charlie Newell. the artistic director at the Court Theater in Hyde Park. He is also the director of the latest Tom Stoppard play, The Hard Problem, which is on stage at the Court through April 9th. I mean, it's great to talk about the work that you do with playwrights. It's also interesting, too, because the Court puts an emphasis on the classics. What does that mean? When I say that, I kind of don't even know what that means.
Well, you know, recently what it's meant is very quite literally. We did a three-part cycle of Greek classic plays. And so that's a very narrow and specific definition of theater. And what other theater in this city, much less the country, is doing three-play cycles of Greek tragedy? We were very honored. We got invited by the Getty Villa out in Malibu to bring our production of Iphigenia and Aulis out there, which we'll be playing in September, October of this year. But to go to your question more directly, I mean, to me, you know, a classic is a play that deals with the timeless themes, the universal truths, the things that we all can connect to in some way. And part of our job as theater artists and when we're working on classics is not only understanding from where that original idea came from. You know, Shakespeare didn't sit down or Molière didn't sit around and say, I'm going to write a classic. Right. He was like, I'm writing about something that's true to me right now. So part of our work is obviously to go back and try to, as best we can, it's an interpretive act, understand what was that initial impulse, but then how to bring it, this is the sort of the translation mode of it, how to bring it forward so it means something to people today.
And that's the idea of trying to find meaning in some of the plays that are written in different times, different generations.
Totally. And for me, that's the thrill. And so early previews are some of my favorite time because you know right away whether the choices that you've made, is it landing with the audience? Are they connecting with what you think that writer, whenever they wrote the play, was actually after and now are we connecting today?
So are there a lot of, I mean, it's interesting because there's probably, how many times in your career, your esteemed career, 23 years down at the Court, have you put a play on and previews like, no, maybe this should have stayed in the 16th century.
Well, frankly, it's usually more of maybe our choices about how to bring this forward were not as, you know, serving. Maybe we didn't understand the 16th century well enough. But that's been my training from the beginning is and I've had an extraordinary group of mentors, you know, master directors who I would observe in rehearsal and how they brought their own personal passionate point of view. And therefore, my job, I think, is as much about, Charlie, you know, read this play, and if it means something, if you get moved by it, but you don't understand what that is, there must be something powerful going on in there that through the process of casting, design, rehearsal, performance, we could really get at, and maybe others, like the team around me, as well as an audience, could tap into that same kind of emotional response. So for me, it comes right down to, am I moved? Do I read this play and feel something that surprises me, is unexpected? Because if there is that kernel there, then I follow that. It's a very instinctive way of season planning. Sometimes my marketing department bugs me because they go, Charlie, what's the theme of the season? I go, I don't know. I just really like that play and that play and that
play.
Well,
I was going to ask you. I was going to save that for a little bit later, but we'll get into it.
Yeah.
I mean, as director, I mean, you will bring Tom Stoppard play to the stage as it is now, running through April 9th. But as an artistic director, your job is to plan out a season, to think about the plays that are going to be on stage at the Court.
Yeah.
Talk about the process. Let's get into the mind of Charlie Newell. When you set out to put a season together in a Chicago theater, especially at the Court.
Yeah.
What are things that you have to think about?
Well, I mean, there's so many variables about balance and budget and audience and marketing and all of those other things. But frankly, I try not to worry about any of that up front. It goes back to this very simple emotional response that I described earlier. And then who are the artists, myself obviously included as the principal artist of the theater, who are the artists that could best bring that forward? And do we have that artistic power to be able to do that? And so it's really an intuitive, instinctive response. One of the things I've learned is, you know, if you have an idea and you have a sense about a play, follow it, and if it starts to generate another idea that then provokes another thought, and oh, that person and that director and that choreographer, but if the snowball of the idea starts going, whereas other times I'm like, yeah, I really love this play, and then it'll just kind of sit there and nothing happens, and we go, maybe we won't do that.
Are you consciously thinking about, you know, not to sound like one of your board members. What's the theme, Charlie? I mean, but are you constantly thinking about how the plays that you map out for a season connect to each other?
You know, I really don't. I really think about them as individual events and try to really be unique about it, about what those events specifically are. Frankly, it's only in retrospect, and maybe smarter and wiser people than me look back and go, well, Charlie, that season was about this and that and the other thing.
Let them do that, right?
Exactly. I don't, and you know, other artistic directors do and are very successful in this. I don't set out with, we're going to do a theme about isolation or about broken hearts or about, you know, something or political crisis or whatever. It's really about the individual. And, you know, on any given year, I'm reading over 200 plays, either for the first time or over again many times, just to keep every idea thriving. And that's just the plays that I read all the way through as opposed to the ones that I look at. So, yeah, I have my playwrights wall in my office.
I just had this image of Charlie Newell sitting there going, it was a dark and stormy. Next!
Exactly.
I don't have time for this.
No, it's more like, wait a minute, what about Molière? Let's go to the Molière section. No, nothing there. Oh, what about Spanish Golden Age?
I mean, as a theater professional, as an artistic director, I mean, do you find yourself reading plays for leisure, for entertainment, or is it all work?
Reading plays is really hard. I find it extremely difficult because, frankly, when I, and I'm sure others have this experience as well, you know, you read it, but you imagine it, right, in your mind, because it's only about the language, the spoken language. So play reading time is any, I mean, for example, I have to block out 3 to 4 hours of quiet, uninterrupted time to read a 2-hour play, just because I need that kind of contemplative quiet time to really hear the play as I read it to imagine whether it's something worth us doing. And again, I'm always looking for, where's that emotional catch? Where's that place that I go, oh my God, I'm feeling something, and they're talking about things I don't know anything about. Do you know? So it's very intuitive. It's not particularly logical.
Let's do this. Let's take a break and we'll get an update on tonight's news. In studio with me, Charlie Newell. He's the artistic director of the Court Theater in Hyde Park. The new show is The Hard Problem. It is on stage through April 9th at the Court. It's the latest from writer Tom Stoppard. Charlie Newell, my guest tonight at the big table. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest in studio tonight, Charlie Newell, the artistic director of the Court Theater in Hyde Park. He's been there for 23 years. It's a long time to be there, Charlie. One job. I stayed at one job for 20 years. I understand it, but being in the artistic world, that's a career.
It is. My wife and my newly married bride, when we moved to Chicago in 1992, we had no idea that this would be our fortune. And I just consider myself, again, the luckiest guy in show business because both Hyde Park, my kids growing up in Hyde Park, going to the lab school. Now they're both off at college. They're 22 and 20, Jake and Luke. We have a neighborhood. We have a family. And what's interesting, though, for me about the job is that maybe it's because I get bored quickly. Every 3 to 5 years, I'm reinventing for myself what the job is and who I am as an artist. So, for example, in the last few years, you'll see in Court's work, I've been doing a lot more work with new plays that are either adaptations or even brand new scripts by writers. And the play we did to open the season, Man in the Ring by Michael Christopher,
We had him in here, yeah.
Was an extraordinary artistic experience, and I never imagined I'd be sitting in a room with Michael Christopher.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but do you run the risk is not the right word, but do you challenge your audiences when the Court has been known for years to present the classics, to reinterpret the classics, to bring it to. Do you run the risk of audience confusion when you approach new work or try something different that might be out of that mission and category that the Court has been so defined in?
Yeah, it's a very good question, and I think about it and worry about it, and then I say, well, let's just do the work we really believe in and continue to take the kind of risk that has earned us the reputation that we have, and hope that the audience will go with it. And so far, they certainly have. I mean, I've gone through iterations. I mean, for a while, I was doing a lot of musical work, and Porgy and Bess was probably the
right
kind of pinnacle moment of that journey. For a while, I was doing a lot of French Baroque comedy. For a while, you know, it's like I kind of go through cycles, as does the theater. And I got to mention Ron O.J. Parson, who's our resident artist, who's done an extraordinary work of bringing the African-American classics to court stage, most recently for Blues from Alabama Sky, which just was spectacular early this year. So my belief is that I, as an individual artist, and Court as an artistic institution, we have to constantly be pushing and challenging ourselves to take the next risk. We've all been to theater, even no artists perhaps, who think, oh, the only way I can build my career is if I keep doing that thing I always do
right,
that always maybe gets nice reviews and
right
does well. But I go to the theater when I see that work and I think, oh, been there, done that. What's the challenge? What's the next place? Sometimes we take risk and it doesn't come out as well as we'd hoped. But we're in such a generous audience here in Chicago where that even when the accomplishment may not be what you'd hoped, the ambition is still reward.
Charlie Newell is also he's the director of The Hard Problem. It's on stage now. It's the latest play from writer Tom Stoppard, running through April 9th. Let's go back to the classics. I mean, because even next season, you're going to direct Arthur Miller's All My Sons.
Yeah.
One of the things about the plays that you've done, and you've directed over 50 at the Court, as they are so varied and they're so all over the map, from, like you mentioned, the cycle of Greek plays to to Molière to Tom Stoppard to, you know, Arthur Miller.
Yeah,
it's surprising to me, and I try to ask this question in a way that I don't sound so foolish, but it's amazing to me what the written word can do. And the fact that over centuries and centuries, as human beings, we've been writing down words in this form, and they still resonate today, and they still make it to stage in 2017 at places like the Court.
Yeah.
For you as an artistic director, does that at all resonate, the idea that, do you think about the history of that word, the history of plays, and the way that human beings have communicated?
Absolutely. I mean, if I can describe my own personal calling in life, is to create transformative emotional experiences for myself and for my community. And thank God that the theater does that so powerfully and, to my mind, so uniquely, where we all gather in a room and listen to a single person speak or sing something in which we all have this kind of communal act of imagining ourselves and going on that journey. I think, you know, not to get a little on a soapbox here, I think the need for that communal connection is even more necessary given how much our technology isolates us in so many different
right
ways, and how much our politics bifurcates everybody. So getting everybody in the room to experience, to find the common ground together, is something that I think theater has a unique power to do.
I think about all those things that you just mentioned, politics or even technology.
Yeah.
Not only do they isolate, but they distract, and they also take audiences away.
Yeah.
As the theater grows, and not just here in Chicago, but just the fact that human beings are on stage,
yeah,
those are some challenges. The idea that I don't need to leave my chair because I can turn my phone on and I can watch a play.
Totally.
I can watch them. But there's a lot of different things to do. Do you think about that as a leader in Chicago theater, leading the Court Theater, about the challenges of getting butts in seats?
Oh, all the time. And rather than try to, oh, we should have more technology in our work, or we should have, I don't know, my strong belief is we just got to do better theater. And we got to do what we do best better. And that's another reason why I'm kind of a restless soul. I'm always looking for the next risk and challenges. I'm perhaps famously known for, or infamously, at Court Theater, is I come into office and go, I read this play last night. It terrifies me. I don't know how to do it. We're going to do it. So the more challenged I am by it, I follow that instinct, because I know that I'm going to be provoking the text itself and myself to stretch, because that's what we're asking an audience to do. We're asking you to come in and have this experience where maybe you'll get changed. Maybe something is going to move in you that could only happen in that environment, uniquely through theater. So, again, I think the theater has an invaluable place in our culture these days, and I'm constantly thinking about how can we best do it to celebrate celebrate as fast.
A lot of what you talk about, this idea, oh, there's this scary play. It's way too ambitious. Let's do it.
Yeah.
You know, I hear from so many different theater artists that come through here, and yeah. they talk about the Chicago ethos, what makes Chicago a great theater town. It's not ultimately the product. It's the process
yeah,
in the
totally.
Way that so many
totally.
People. And I guess the question I have for you is, it sounds like, from, you know, as I have different actors come in and why they stay, why they don't go to other coasts, things like that. It sounds to me that that's something that has been forged over time and maybe forged by the actions of artistic directors who have spent 23 years in their job. But I'm saying that we might,
yeah,
instead
yeah.
of, you know, just saying that this is an, it's something that, I mean, you have helped design the mm-hmm. Chicago ethos when it comes to art and theater.
Well, that's a very generous comment. I would just say that for me, the marker of success, while reviews and awards and ticket sales are wonderful, but for me personally, as well as how I look at the art of court theater, is how much did we grow? How much did we change by having this process? And for me, some of the proudest moments are when actors and designers and others say, you know, Charlie, I've been changed as an artist. I've grown as an artist as a result of working here. And I think that happens in so many theaters in Chicago, and why people are so hungry for that continued, you know, kind of lifelong learning, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Every day I got to think about how to do that, because it's, you're never done. You're never finished. And that's one of the things that I love about it. Of my late great mentor, former artistic director of the Guthrie Theater, Garland Wright, said, Charlie, if you really want to be a director, you got to commit your life to a never-ending journey of discovery about process. And I said, sign me up, because that sounds, you know, people talk about the idea of, oh, when are you going to retire? I'm 58. I never want to retire, because why would I ever want to stop that kind of growth? So I try to bring that every day to my work.
One of the best, the artistic director of the Court Theater, Charlie Newell, who is also the director of The Hard Problem, the latest play from writer Tom Stoppard. It runs through April 9th at the Court in Hyde Park. Can't thank you enough, Charlie, for coming in and being my guest tonight.
Justin, you're awesome. Thank you.
Great to talk to Charlie Newell there. I'm excited. I don't know when. I'd love to get down and see that play. You know?
I saw Rock and Roll, Tom Stoppard's Rock and Roll.
Oh, yeah?
It was great.
Yeah. I feel like I need more Tom Stoppard in my life.
I think everybody does.
Everybody needs some more Tom Stoppard in their life. That was the song I'm working on.
Very nice.
Very nice. All right. So this big weekend, man. The story in Chicago sport. I mean, there's so much going on with Chicago sports. Of course, Northwestern tomorrow, the second round of the tournament.
Mm-hmm.
Another great story. The Chicago Blackhawks. They're 3 points up on the Wild. The Wild are spiraling out of contention. As the Blackhawks continue to just slay up in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
I think a big one with Toronto tomorrow.
Yep.
They are 3 points up, where I think at the beginning of the week, I remember from the carryout, I think that they were a point back.
Yeah, Minnesota's been struggling.
I mean, it's still a little bit of time left to play, but right now the Blackhawks are putting some distance between them. And that's great. That's a number one seed.
The Hawks they've played one more game. I think the Hawks have played 70 and the Wild have played 69.
I forgot, and every year I forget, the wacky way they do the playoffs for hockey. There's like a little wrinkle where it's like the first seed and the second seed play and then they divide by four.
Yeah, it was weird. Like, they just take instead of just going the entire Western Conference 1-8-2-7, they take the
top two leagues,
division is, the top four teams. So I think like the Hawks were second last year, and then they ended up playing, did they play Toronto or St. Louis, who was the third team,
right.
Or that St. Louis was the second team, and the Hawks were the third team. So they were really good teams playing each other in the first round. You didn't get like the one team playing an eight team. So, like, this year, I think, I mean, there's a possibility, you know, if the Hawks are one, they would play maybe Nashville or something like that, a team that they could probably handle. But if they end up, in second, they might have a they'd have to play the third
yeah,
team. Yeah,
I hate when they try to shove math into my sports. You know, I blame it on Common Core. I really do.
But Ray, shouldn't it be though? Like though, you know, you just get the top eight teams in the Western Conference.
Right. I mean, I get like the idea that maybe if you win the division, you should get the two seed. You know, like instead of that concept of doing basketball. But yeah, I mean, it just confuses you on what you're actually, and who you're actually going to play.
Don't want to send. You know, you don't want to send in the first round. You're sent instead of playing teams that are closer to you, like St. Louis, Minnesota. You're sending them out to California to play.
Oh, I see.
San Jose and Anaheim and things like that. Maybe
they got to save on miles, man. It costs a lot of money to put gas in an airline.
It's gonna be an exciting last few weeks of the season.
No,
sure.
I mean it's unbelievable to think we're almost to the end of the season. I mean, something like April 7th or right in that area is like the final of the
regular season.
Right, April 8th maybe. Wow.
Well, let's hope the playoffs go two months.
They are right. But they will. I have a feeling they're going to – they look pretty great. But the – so you got those two stories. Then you got sort of the demise and sort of implosion of the Bulls.
Lost again, right?
Got beat again. And they are now – it's not even like that even close. I haven't looked right at the standings right now, but – I mean, I think it was maybe a week and a half ago, the Bulls were the sixth seed.
And now they're 10th?
They're 10th. I mean, they're falling further behind in the way that they're two, three games back. You know, and you'd say, oh, well, they can make that up. And I'm like, well, I'm not sure if they can if they're not winning any games.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
I mean, even if they sneak in at 8.
Right. They got to sneak in at 7. If they could sneak in at 7, getting something like that would be great. But you're right. I mean, it doesn't matter. And then, the best part is here comes baseball. Kyle Schwarber hit a 3-run home run today.
Mm-hmm.
Drove in 4. There seems to be, you know, here comes the storylines about who's actually going to start, you know, and things of that nature. Like we talked about earlier this week, Charlie Tilson, the center fielder for the Sox, is already on the DL. So there's going to be some shakeup there, but that's a week and a half, 2 weeks away now.
Coming up, I saw a picture from Cubs camp today, and they had a leprechaun, some sort of leprechaun there.
I will say this: I remember when I have a very early memory where I was in first grade. This is probably the only memory I have of first grade. I feel like it's all gone, right? Too many books I have to read for this show.
The stack gets higher and higher.
Yeah. I remember my first grade teacher, she did a thing where during St. Patrick's Day when we showed up, there was like candies that led to the classroom. And you opened the classroom and she had like, you know, sort of shamrocked it up. And put like butterscotch candies and things everywhere. It was like a huge treat. So I remember this. And I'm so embarrassed by this. But like in second grade, I was walking by. And as I walked by, the first graders were in the process of that discovery.
Uh-oh.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you're going to open the door and there's going to be a bunch of shamrocks and butterscotch candies in there. I know. It's terrible, isn't it? Oh. I feel like I'm in therapy. And Miss Thorn, I think it was Thornwall. Was that her name? I can't remember her name. She got really mad at me and I loved her. I loved her. Like, I was just, like, you know, just infatuated with that teacher. And, like, it taught me a lesson that, you know, I shouldn't ruin other people's surprises. So at least I got a lesson out of it.
Yeah. That's what is school for learning a lesson every day?
What is school, if not, for learning not to ruin first graders' St. Patrick's Day experience? So, yeah, so I was not too happy about that. But luckily, the first graders weren't paying, you know, they're dumb. I'm 6-year-old. I'm 7 at the time. I have a better understanding of the world around me.
Yeah.
You know, the 6-year-olds are just like, what? Yeah, they're not paying attention to me. So at least, you know, I have that going for me. But yeah, I was never forget. I was like, that's not me. I went home, looked in the mirror. I'm like, that's not me. I'm not going to be that kid. So from that point out, you could tell me anything. I wouldn't tell anybody.
Has that been with you for a long time, and that why you don't care about St. Patrick's Day? Because
you're
just like burying it deep down.
Maybe I just let it out. Maybe next year I'll have Pete McMurray's full green suit on I'll be full into it. But yeah, right now I just go with the pastel green that I'm wearing.
Yeah, it looks good. It looks good.
Thank you, buddy. All right, Patty Vasquez coming up here. She is taking over at 11 o'clock. She'll be in studio. Stay with us. That's going to do it. Patty Vasquez coming up next. I will say next week, big week. Tracy Letts is going to join us. Also, David Auburn, the playwright, Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright, play like Proof. Also, Danny Boyle, the tremendous, tremendous Oscar award-winning director, Trainspotting 2. And Pete Holmes, the HBO show Crashing, going to join us. So, big week. Patty Vasquez up next. Patty!
St.
Patrick's
Day. Your beer is all warm, my friend. What's happening in here?
No, it's not my beer.
Belt and suspenders.
It's probably been in here all day. Yeah. It's been a alcohol-infused day of St. Patrick's Day coverage.
No kidding. Well, and it continues because we'll have whiskey and a cookie.
Yeah, there you go.
Seems appropriate.
Yeah, that's right. I apologize for the shows before us.
Have you
Those
seen
have been
my...
On the, that's been on the table for like 4 hours.
Have you
five
seen
hours.
My show at 2 a.m.?
Yeah. I have not.
I believe as Nick D always says, it looks like there's been a rave.
Just think Animal House.
Yes, a little bit of that. Yeah. That happens.
What do you got on the show tonight?
We have Representative Stephanie Kifowit in our green room now. So it's funny, I was asking her about what she thought about Rep. Gazzardi's interview with you, and she goes, I don't live stream constantly WGN radio. So we'll address a lot of things. That was an excellent interview. I think
he was good. I thought it was interesting. You know, like they have I wonder if there is more pressure now that the federal government has said, this is what we're going to do with the budget. Mm-hmm. States take it away, and our state is in disrepair.
Even Governor Rauner has said, this will not be good for us. I mean, we have, you know, for the last 3 years, we have gone unfunded for a lot of, you know, $11 million out the door every single day. We don't have a budget. And you know, the thing about that federal budget and the same thing with the state budget is it really is, you know, a demonstration of what your values are.
Right.
And as Will Gazzardi mentioned, it's, you know, basically we're going to say that defense is most important. Education, social services are secondary and should be taken over, hopefully, by the state. But we're not doing that now. And
if
that means
not
a lot
the state,
of people,
right.
Yeah, a lot
right.
of people will suffer.
Well, okay, looking
so
forward to
good
it.
Good times. And then also, happy St. Patrick's Day.
And happy St. Patrick's Day. Have a great weekend.